Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Really looking forward to the card that we have coming up this weekend. As always, one half of your hosting duo, at Craig Allen, FNP. You can find Matt over on Twitter and Instagram, at Matt Allen, FNP. And of course, we have UFC Fight Night, Blaydes versus Lewis. Finally, of course, the first pairing had to be kind of shuffled around. It was unfortunate that we did lose that fight late last year. But look at this fight card, Matt. We already have 15 fights scheduled. I know a couple have been shuffled around. Pat Sabatini in for Mike Trezano taking on Rafael Alves. And you look up and down through this one, Matt. We've already talked about a few of these fights. I mean, you look at that main event, but also Sergey Spivak, Jared Vandera, that one was moved around. We had Eamon Zahabi taking on Draco, the great Dracolini Rodriguez. All kinds of great fights, though, on this. And a lot of fighters that are, you know, in either their second or third booking in the UFC, a few debuts as well. So while it might not be the most talent-rich card, it is an exciting one. I can see a couple of stars really emerging out of this one, and a lot of fighters that we should definitely watch. A couple of aging legends on our main card, too. So overall, what's your take on this one?
This really is just a card full of crossroads fights. And other than the main event, you just look kind of up and down this card. You've got the Olytic versus the Dawkins. You've got the Arlovskis versus the Aspinalls. You've got the Jakar Close versus the Luis Peña. Now, yes, Close not as much of a veteran as those other guys, but just a lot of more established names fighting those less experienced, sort of up-and-coming prospects, if you will. And this is a really fun fight card. Now, yes, there is 15 fights on it, so I'm sure it'll probably be down to like 12 or 11 by the time we get to Saturday. But really exciting card top to bottom, and hopefully it does stay intact for Saturday.
All kinds of great prospects on this card. And as we always do, Matt, with Fight Night Picks, really looking forward to question mark kicks over on Saturday. But trying to give our best thoughts on a possible fight tonight. So let's throw it over to the Fight of the Night screen, presented, of course, as always, by Manscaped. A fight of the night, it's maybe not always dependent on those big names. And of course, we have Blaydes and Lewis ranked in the top five of our heavyweight division in the main event. But Matt, for me, Juicy J, and it's not the guy that was in the Katy Perry song that one time that went Juicy, but Juicy J, he's had three different stints in the UFC, and he has a combined record of 2-4 in those three stints. Yes, he lost Artem Lobov on The Ultimate Fighter, and he beat our guy, Marcin Rocek. But if you look at Julian Rosa, part and parcel, very complete fighter, very exciting guy to watch. And I know, you know, there's plenty of finished losses on his record, a total of 24-8 career. But you look at this guy, and especially in his last performance, A, he can stand in the pocket and trade. But B, he can wrestle a little bit. He's got a little bit of jiu-jitsu. Like, he's definitely a guy to watch. And for Nate Landwehr opposite him, the train, the former M1 champ, he just went on an absolute heater coming into the UFC. A lot of people had eyes on Nate Landwehr in his debut. He took on Herbert Burns, and yikes, the train kind of hit the skids. But his last time out looked good against Darren Elkins. What a fun fight that was. Definitely have to consider this a possible fight of the night.
100%. Now, the one attribute that both these guys share is their hitability. And you're probably thinking, well, that's not a good thing to have. It's a great thing to have if you do want to be involved in a fight of the night. Like you had said, Nate Landwehr, constant more forward pressure, always moving forward, never takes a step back. And he is just a wild man. He's kind of like if Mike Perry wasn't from Florida and was just a little bit more subdued outside the cage. He just moves forward. And like you had said, yelling at Dana White, just a really good personality around Nate Landwehr. It is more than just the fight. It is the walkout. It is him and kind of all of his antics. For Juicy J, Julia Rosa, you don't get back into the UFC three times without just being really, really, really tough. And we've seen him multiple times in the Contender Series. We've seen him multiple times in the UFC. He's never out of a fight. You can even go back to the Sean Woodson fight where he was a massive underdog and everyone, including us, completely counted him out. And you just see he weathers the storm. He can take those big shots from Woodson and just sort of can get himself back into the fight as it progresses, and he's never completely out, no matter how bad it looks for Julian Rosa. So I do agree, this is one of the more fun fights on this card.
This is going to be a great one. I'm sure Nate Landwehr is probably going to haul Julian Rosa into some sort of dogfight, hopefully in the cage, not outside. But it's one of those ones that you definitely want to pay attention to, and it should provide fireworks at 145 pounds. And our second pick for a possible fight of the night, Canadian Eamon Zahabi back in the UFC octagon. It has been a long time since we've seen Eamon Zahabi, almost 2 years. We're getting very close to that. This fight was originally scheduled closer to the end of the year. We had already talked about it. Zahabi, Rodriguez, the newcomer at 7-1, a guy that spent time with King in the Cage. But if you look at Draco Rodriguez's fight, similar to Nate Landwehr, this guy will kind of throw caution to the wind and go a little bit crazy, and it's worked out great for him. Only the one loss in his pro career to Tony Gravely. That Tony Gravely. It was a 5-round fight. It was, you know, pretty much all Tony Gravely in that one. But Draco Rodriguez, aside from that, has put on some very impressive performances. And from Ayman Zahabi, when he's not thinking too much and he just lets everything go, he is the type of guy that can put on a very impressive performance. And I know if you look at his last two fights, both of them losses, one to Ricardo Hamosh and then to Vince Morales. Maybe not the best fights for Ayman Zahabi, but he had flashes in that Hamosh fight. And if he brings it all together, you want to go back and watch a fun fight. Reginaldo Vieira, which is a fight that we were at, his one and only UFC win back at UFC Halifax. That was a really good one if you're a big Ayman Zahabi fan. So if he can bring it all together, and if he matches up well against Draco Rodriguez, like we know he could in this one, this could be a possible fight of the night.
Oh, I agree 100%. Now, a lot of ifs you just threw out during all of that, but I do think this is going to be a really fun fight. Zahabi is the more technical out of the two, but like you had mentioned, with Rodriguez's striking, just his fighting style in general, he's going to force a brawl out of Zahabi, so it will be a really fun fight to see whether or not the technique and the footwork of Zahabi will be enough to just get over sort of the general craziness, if you will, of Draco Rodriguez. So another really fun fight, and that's the thing. These fights to kind of get buried on the prelims, you're probably not that excited for, but there are some absolutely phenomenal ones out there, and this is just one of the, all there's five, there's 15 fights in this card. There's a lot of great fights top to bottom, and yeah, this is just one of the top ones.
This is one that we're definitely looking forward to. And from Ayman Zahabi, it was a COVID test that ended up positive. He couldn't make it to the States for the original booking, coming in from Montreal, Quebec, Canada to this one, so we're really looking forward to it. Our two possible fight of the nights. As always, those Fight of the Night screens presented to you by Manscaped. Head on over to manscaped.com. Use the promo code FNP. You're going to save 20% off your order and get free shipping. Make your testes your besties. Matt, I'll talk about my testes a little bit later on. Maybe I'm wearing my Manscaped underwear right now. But make sure you head on over there. Supporting the sponsors help us as well. And if you want to help us directly, maybe head on over to fightnightpicks.com. We've got some great articles over there. We got one in the chamber with a really interesting fighter from our own Joshua Hart. So fightnightpicks.com, you got the store, the Under Armour hats are over there. And hey, maybe we're getting ready for baseball season in February. We got the Fight Night Picks baseball jersey as well. Something cool to have for yourself. Hang it up, wear it. Maybe you're hanging out watching the fights on a Saturday. You're going to watch a 15-fight card hanging out with the boys. You want to support them? You wear that baseball jersey. Now, Matt, like I said, I'm really looking forward to this card. A lot of great fights on tap. You got the former WEC champ, Eddie Wineland, taking on John Castaneda. We've got some aging heavyweights on here as well with Andrei Arlovsky and Alexei Olenek. It's a lot of great action. I'm really looking forward to this one, Matt. So as we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. What a great fight we have in UFC newcomers Rafael Alves taking on Pat Sabatini. Sabatini in 8 days' notice, replacing Mike Trezano, who was out due to an ankle injury. And Matt, for both of these guys, former champions from other organizations. For Rafael Alves, the former interim lightweight champ with Titan down in Florida. And for Pat Sabatini, the former featherweight champ with CFFC. Now, he had two different reigns as their featherweight champ. His last fight, he won his belt back. Now, if you go back to early 2020, one of the nastiest injuries I've seen in a fight, and as soon as Pat Sabatini's arm broke against the one and only 5-3 at the time, James Gonzalez, you knew the fight was over. It was awful. It was disgusting. He came back just months later, and he was able to pick up a really big win against none other than Jordan Tatone, who was 7-5 at the time. You go back and watch that fight, Sabatini really just had his way in the fight. He just kept landing his right hand up against the cage, and he eventually got the win there. And then in his next fight against Jesse Stern, who was 10-3 at the time, picked up a big armbar finish. Now, Matt, Pat Sabatini's taken on a decent level of competition throughout his career. Those last two, little salty. I mean, if you look at Stern's record, maybe he hadn't fought in a little over a year. Maybe he hadn't fought the highest level of competition. There was an 8-8 and a 3-3 before this fight with Sabatini, the former champion with the organization. But he's picking up wins the way you would hope a guy would pick up wins in coming into the UFC. And if you look at Rafael Alves, I mean, holy smokes, this guy is on an absolute heater of a win streak. If you go back and look at some of the names too, they're definitely names that you'd recognize from that regional scene.
Rudy Morales with Combate, Guillerme Miranda with Titan, Belbit Nazarov with Titan. Then he gets the win on Contender Series. And listen, that was a great fight that he had if you watch the fight against Alejandro Flores. And then before that, and this is where it gets interesting, he fought Felipe Douglas over with Titan. He gets that interim belt. There was a long layoff between fights, and it's interesting to see a guy like that, especially with, you know, a record of, what, 19-9 at the time. He's 30 years old. He was on Dana White's Looking for a Fight on that Titan card against Felipe Douglas, and here is the exact quote from Dana White. He said, normally with a record, or with the record Alves has, I wouldn't be that interested, but he looked impressive. Kid's a great athlete, and so he just waited. They offered him a chance on Contender Series, and he waited almost a year and a half to take on, like I said, a really tough out in Alejandro Flores. So you got Alves coming in here, really, really heavy-handed, somewhat reserved, and that's the weird thing, because we see two totally different Rafael Alves in his fight.
Well, you say reserved, and it's interesting, too, because sometimes he will just throw caution to the wind, and he does put a lot behind his shots, and that's something that concerns me a little bit, but also he's going to make Pat Sabatini pay quite a bit in this fight, because Alves, although he doesn't throw a lot of strikes, he throws a lot behind all of his strikes. And he will throw, it's just crazy kind of 1-2 hook combo. And then he might throw in a kick, and then it's reset. And it's, I'm going to throw my big power shots and then reset. When those power shots land, they will start to accumulate, especially as the fight progresses. And the great thing for Alves, too, if the striking is going very well, and let's say he is starting to piece up Sabatini throughout that first round, going into the second, if Sabatini shoots for a takedown, Alves is very dangerous on the ground. And when you do go through his record, tons of not only knockouts, but submissions as well. And that's the great thing for Alves. He always has that in his back pocket to where if he is getting the better of the striking exchanges and his opponent tries to just, oh, panic, take him down, he's got that great guillotine. That's something we talk about a lot with the Nick Lentz of the world, the Brian Kelleher's of the world. I'm not putting Rafael Alves in that category just yet. But to have that weapon in your toolbox, in your UFC debut, is a really nice thing to have. And against a guy like Pat Sabatini, who, again, is another very well-rounded fighter who can get it done on the feet, can get it done on the mat, it's just a great little wrinkle for Alves to have in this fight.
Both of these guys coming out of great camps as well. For Alves, coming out of MMA Masters, you know Colby Covington's there now, but Danny Chavez, who's also on this card, Ricardo Lamas, a longtime MMA Masters guy. For Pat Sabatini, if you have a look, depending on what site you go to, NPR Endurance MMA, I know if you watch his fights on CFFC, they mention that, but as well, Henzo Gracie Philly, and if you look at the level of training partner that he has there, Sean Brady's of the world, but a couple of other names that I was able to throw down, Jeremiah Wells, that, you know, UFC signee, he was supposed to have a fight last year that kind of fell out on late notice, as well as Jonathan Webb, fellow UFC vet as well. So some good names for both of these two guys. Very accredited in jiu-jitsu, they both are as well. They're both Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belts, and that's the thing. I mean, for Alves, we see it where in certain fights, I mean, I think the prime example is a fight against Guillerme Miranda. He just shoots in as quick as he can, just lands an absolute crazy flurry of attack, and then he just kind of pulls off a little bit. And you'll see that in the Alves fights where he goes wild, and then he just takes time off. And he just kind of mirrors his opponent, stands there, he'll throw a single shot, maybe the 1-2, maybe he'll throw in a leg kick as well. I know if you go back and watch his fight against, it was the one against Bibit Nazarov, where Alves hurt his right leg, and then right at the end, kind of able to get the guillotine choke. And if you watch the fight against, it was his last one against Alejandro Flores, it was kind of a fight where Flores was fighting on the back foot, but he was landing quite a bit, which you could definitely see Pat Sabatini doing in this fight. And then Alves decided, you know what, my nickname's The Turn. Well, I'm going to turn the tables. I'm just going to run in, throw one shot, pull guillotine as tight as possible, and he finished that fight. So it was an amazing finish for Alves. And if you go back and, again, watch those fights with Titan, he had a bit of a fluffer, I think. And, you know, if you've watched any dirty movie, they have fluffers to get those guys ready for the show. For Alves, there was one fight they had him listed as 5'11 with a 70.5-inch reach. Another fight, he was 5'7 with a 70-inch reach. UFC and Dana White's Contender Series had him at 5'8", 68 inches of reach, so I don't know who was holding the measuring tape, but apparently they didn't know what they were doing with Titan, and we're going to take the UFC's numbers off of that. So for Alves, we had two comparables. I will go with the Pat Sabatini comparable. I'll give you the Alvish one
here. Okay, so just one last point from me, too, on this fight. This fight could be a little dangerous if you are high on Alvis. And I'm not going to give my prediction away just right yet. But this fight could go similar to the Luis Cote, Sasha Palatnikov fight, where you might see Alvis constantly pushing forward, landing big power shots. But he might tire himself out landing those power shots. And I think that's an important point we have to make.
I think I can lend credence to that, too, because if you look at Alvis, heavily, heavily muscled at 155 pounds. And again, the last fight was at 145. This one's at 145. A lot of different sites have him just listed straight up as a lightweight. I know there's usually some lag on the old interwebs, but at 45, he looked good in his last fight. He weighed in at 146 pounds, but that's the thing. Heavily muscled guy, not the tallest guy. I know Titan, again, kind of fitting with the numbers, but you're right. You could really gas out if you go for that early push against a guy like Pat Sabatini.
Well, especially the way he throws his punches, too. If you're just throwing a lot behind your shots and you're never landing, you're just whiffing on everything. And that's just going to draw your momentum away and get you more out of position. Against a guy like Sabatini who can throw straight shots, it's not that I think Sabatini's a more powerful guy by any means, but it might be one of those Macy Barber, Alexa Grasso situations where the one who does throw the straight shots, if you catch Alves while he's throwing some big bomb, he's out of position, you might be able to hurt him with a straight shot down the middle. It's a tough ask for Sabatini, though, because here's the thing. I would have loved to have seen the original fight of Trezano versus Alves. Would have been a phenomenal fight. Mike Trezano, he's good at wrestling. He's a very well-rounded fighter. We all know him from The Ultimate Fighter. Sabatini, I think, is a good prospect who has a good future in the UFC. It's just a really hard ask for him to beat a guy like Rafael Alves on only 8 days' notice.
And with Alves, and you see this out of every commentary team that's covered one of his fights, it's, well, he can let his hands go and he can throw these crazy power shots because of how good his ground game is. You're taking on a Pat Sabatini that's a pretty good wrestler in his own right. He has pretty good jiu-jitsu as well. Again, we talked about the fact they're both Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belts. For Alves, the other thing that he does, and I don't love this, at the start of just about every fight, he does a jumping flip, which, like, listen, you're not Carl Edwards. What are you doing? So he does that at the start of every fight. If Paul Felder is commentating, and I know he did in Alvish's last fight, he will crucify that. Like, most MMA fighters hate seeing that because you can blow out a knee, you can blow out an ankle. You've seen injuries from stuff like that after fights. You hate to see it. I mean, Dana White hates it when Justin Gaethje does it. So if you see a guy like Alves do it, A, you don't like it, but B, he throws spinning wheel kicks, he throws hook kicks, he'll throw an axe kick. Like, he throws all these wild, unorthodox techniques because of how good his ground game is. Sabatini, if we could make a comparison between Sabatini and a fighter that you already know and love in the UFC roster, and maybe it's a little bit of bias because the guy's on the card, he reminds me a lot of Charles Rosa. He stands really wide. He will keep a little bit of weight on his front foot. He'll switch stances quite a bit. But he does have good movement, and he has pretty good hand speed as well. So a guy like Charles Rosa, who has that kind of longer karate stance, but again, you know how good his wrestling is, his takedown defense, and his own jiu-jitsu. Pat Sabatini, little bit like Charles Rosa. Matt, who is Rafael Alves a lot like in MMA?
A lot like Lorenz Larkin, because he doesn't have... He's a powerful puncher, but I don't think he's at that upper echelon of power, especially not in the division. But he has really good technique, too. He's just in that weird kind of purgatory, I guess, if you will, of he doesn't throw a crazy amount of volume, but he doesn't have a wild amount of power behind it either. If he catches you with a big shot, you are going to go down. But he is it's that high tie style. He's going to throw those big heavy hooks. He will throw a nice push kick, too. And that's the technique that is very similar to Larkin. He likes to throw that, like, weird sideways push kick off that back leg. It's a good way to get his opponent up against the cage. That we do see that's where he has most of his success, when he is able to get his opponent up against the cage, able to throw volume, especially to the body and to the head. Against a guy like Sabatini, those openings should be there, so I think this is a phenomenal fight.
It is a great fight, so Matt, let's talk about the odds in this one. You have Alves opening a minus 175 favorite, now to minus 195. For Sabatini, open to plus 150, now around to plus 163 over on Best Fight Odds. As far as the Tapology votes are concerned, 539 total votes. You have 83% going with Alves. You have 50% going by submission for Alves. Little bit of a surprise because, again, if you look at Pat Sabatini, out of the three losses, two of them by decision, one unanimous, one split, and then the one where he broke his arm about this time last year. So hopefully we don't have any flashbacks. He's won two in a row, both of them by finish. Alves on that tidy little win streak, as we mentioned. And if you go back and look at his record, I mean, he's fought a decent level of competition. The losses were all pretty close together about 6 years ago. And really, since he's changed his game up, he's found a lot of success in MMA. So final takeaways here. I think it's a great fight. I think it's evenly matched. Little unfortunate that Sabatini coming in on short notice, but you get a chance at the UFC. And really, for Sabatini, if you like him to win this fight, probably going to be switching things up on the back foot, working all the way around the octagon. And listen, you don't see a lot of people have success with it, but similar to the fight that we had in our co-main event last weekend, it's a little bit of that technique versus power, and usually technique wins out. What do you like here?
I think Alves is going to get this one done. Again, Sabatini might be able to win this fight on a full training camp, but you're asking a guy to do not only do his weight cut, but get ready for a tough fight on only a week's notice. So I like Alves in this fight, although I do think for the first fight on the card, this should be an absolute barn burner.
Should be a great fight. I'm in agreement. I'll take Alves here. I mean, again, I like the aggressiveness, I like the jiu-jitsu, and I like the power, but again, you could get caught in a circumstance where you go with Macy Barber based on those techniques. Long layoff for her. For Alves, the last time we saw him, it was against a fighter who had very, very fluid striking in Flores. So we'll see what happens here, but we're both going with Rafael Alves. And for me, maybe I look at this one live, but not straight up. It's a no. really tricky one. It should be a great fight. We're both going with Rafael Alves to get the win. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. We've got a great card headlined by two great heavyweights. We got Curtis Blaydes taking on Derek Lewis finally. So, as we always say, Matt, with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Couple of big heavyweights going at it this weekend. Jared Vandera, the Mountain, making his UFC debut, taking on Polar Bear Sergey Spivak. And this was a fight that we were originally supposed to get last year. We talked about it in great detail. We gave Jared Vandera his props. We gave him his flowers, as they say. Matt, let's jump back into that old prediction video. Matt, really looking forward to our next fight coming up on UFC 256 at heavyweight. And hey, we have a UFC debut from the Mountain. And I'm not talking about the guy from Game of Thrones, but I am talking about a heavyweight in Jared Vandera making his UFC debut representing Team Quest from the Pacific Northwest. And Matt, this is a guy that can get it done in a lot of different ways. He just earned his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He has a background in wrestling. We've seen his striking in his MMA career so far. And if you look at his total body of work, 11-4, 10 of those 11 wins by finish, three submissions, 7 wins by knockout. You saw his big win against Harry Hunsucker, one of the weirdest names in all of sports, over on Dana White's Contender Series just over a month ago. And it was one of those knock him out, grind him out type of fights where Hunsucker really brought it at him at the start. Eventually, kind of, sort of tired out a little bit. Vandera able to take over. And I mean, you look at his overall body of work, and Matt, both of these guys have taken on the one and only Tony Lopez. And Matt, for a guy that has, or at the time, had 95 professional fights, 95 have entered the cage, only 31 at the time have picked up wins. Jared Vandera, one of those guys. Sergey Spivak, also one of those guys. So both these guys, again, share that win in common. And on the left side of our screen, Sergey Spivak, the Polar Bear. So far in the UFC, it's been slightly mixed bags. And they both enter off a win over Tony Lopez. For Spivak, he ends up drawing Walt Harris, gets finished in that fight incredibly quickly. It was in the first minute of the first round. Then he beats Tai Tuivasa, then he loses to Marcin Tybura, and he beats Carlos Felipe in his last time out. A lot of people were surprised about the Felipe win. I know Felipe was coming off of about a 2-year USADA suspension, or there were some USADA issues in there. And Felipe, for what it's worth, looked pretty good against Jorgen De Castro in his last time out. So for Sergey Spivak, to me, the Tuivasa win just continues to look better and better because he really dominated on the ground. And say what you will about Tai Tuivasa, but again, in his last fight against the skyscraper, Stefan Struve, he looked pretty good. So knocked him out twice, too. I mean, just hopping up on the cage. Sometimes you land a heel on a guy's head once he's already been knocked out, and boom goes the dynamite. So again, for Sergey Spivak, his base, he definitely has a good, sambo background to his credit. We see that really implemented into his game. You hear about a lot of fighters with sambo backgrounds. I know Rafael Fiziev, that's going to be fighting later on in the card against Sonato Moicano. He has one, but primarily a Muay Thai kickboxer type of fighter representing Tiger Muay Thai. But for Sergey Spivak, he can really bring it in a lot of different ways. One thing that he does that I don't know if a lot of people really focus in on, he throws a lot of wild shots, and he'll throw spinning stuff that doesn't normally land. So you get Spivak, a lighter heavyweight, if you will, weighed in at 240 his last fight. For Jared Vandera, weighed in at 263, a lot bigger guy in Vandera, a lot smaller of a guy in Spivak. And to me, I look at this fight as old guard, new guard.
I see it a little bit differently, I have to be honest. Jared Vandera in that Hunsucker fight, It wasn't always great, the fact that he was so much bigger. He did have really good positions in that fight, but the start of that fight, he was at a big speed disadvantage. And not to say Sergey Spivak's going to be the guy to go out there and really outstrike Van Der and expose him on the feet. Just something to kind of look forward to moving forward. The smaller guys and that speed did really give Van Der issues. Now, of course, it's really easy to say he came back and he won that fight by first round TKO due to ground and pound. So it's not like it was that bad of a performance from Van Der. It will be interesting, though, because Sergey Spivak, we've seen him dominate in the grappling, but we've also kind of seen him dominate it at other points. The Marcin Tybura fight, and I know Tybura is kind of weird because in some performances he looks really good, like in the Spivak one, and then in other performances he just looks tired and doesn't really do an awful lot. So it does really vary case by case, especially with Spivak, but I do like a lot of the positives that we have seen. I do think the Tai Tuivasa fight was a really good one, and it did show that I was worried in that fight because Walt Harris, phenomenal striker, really explosive guy, and he was able to get to Spivak very fast, and the first shot he landed pretty much put him down. Tai Tuivasa, although I wouldn't say he throws with the same power that a Walt Harris does, he does have phenomenal striking in his own right, and the fact that Spivak was able to kind of stand with him for a little bit, figure out what his game was, and the second that fight went to the ground, it wasn't even close. So this fight really does come down to who can get that top position. If Sergey Spivak's on top of Jared Vandera, he's going to beat the absolute brakes off him. He's going to land really good ground and pound. He'll probably set up. He's got a really nice head and arm choke. He likes going for that instead of passing all the way to mount. If he's in side control, he'll kind of set that up. It's a really nice position for him. But if Vandera is on top of Spivak, it's going to be the exact same problem. I really doubt Vandera will fish for the submission as much as Spivak would, but his ground and pound is definitely violent on top.
That's the thing. I mean, Jared Vandera, with the background in wrestling, comes in having just earned his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. So, I have to give credit where credit's due, Matt. I've got the paper notes this week, and I read an article on Medium. And listen, you don't trust everything you read on Medium, but there was a Q&A there with Justin Sanetti, and this one's from July, before the fight that Vandera had on Contender Series. And there were a lot of really interesting points that were made, but the fact that he talked about really wanting to beat Justin Gaethje's leg kick ratio in the UFC, I thought was absolutely insane. Also learned from some of the interviews and especially that Q&A as well, the fact that he had recently earned his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, definitely something neat. I know if you look at it over on his Tapology page, the fact that he represents, again, Dan Henderson's Athletic Fitness Center and Team Quest, one and the same. Exactly. But he's been training in California for this one out of an affiliate Team Quest location. So I don't know what it's going to be like as far as the level of training partners that we're going to see. From Sergey Spivak, we actually do know he trains with some really, really high-level guys. You can see that up there on screen. But, I mean, for Jared Vandera, again, this to me is one of those fights where you get a guy that's 6'4", so he has a height advantage ever so slightly, has a reach advantage, and he's one of those classic heavyweights. One of those guys that we saw 10 to 12 years ago where I'm a huge fucking heavyweight. I can wrestle and I can strike and I can eat a shot, so I'm probably going to go far. You know who Jared Vandera reminds me of? I'm talking about the fluffer for Brock Lesnar, Chris Tuchscher. A guy that really made it far on all of those attributes, and then he got close to the top, and that was as far as he was going to go, because he wasn't really good at grappling. He was a good wrestler. His striking was pretty good. Then his chin started to kind of fall apart, and the wheels just fell off. But Chris Tuchscher, you want to go find a guy with traps? Go find Chris Tuchscher. You don't hear much about him anymore. So for Jared Vandera, he's one of those guys that can really withstand a lot of punishment. I look at Jared Vandera and I place him in the same class, and maybe this is a little unfair on my part, as a guy like Josh Parisian that we saw come in just a couple of weeks ago against Parker Porter. Parker Porter also in that category too. Like, they're these great big guys at heavyweight that kind of do everything well. They can strike. Again, with Parker Porter, he'll throw some low kicks. Jared Vandera does actually throw a lot of them. You could see that in the fight against Harry Hunsucker early. You saw Vandera start to chop, but what Hunsucker would do is he'd run in with his right hand, just start smashing. And that guy, the speed on him was insane. Like, you rarely see heavyweights throw like that. For Sergey Spivak, again, throws a lot of those spinning shots that don't always land. He kind of gauges distance in a weird way. And if all else fails, then he just goes in for the takedown. It's worked a lot. And hey, credit where credit's due. It's worked against a lot of really big heavyweights too. Because for Tuivasa, for Carlos Felipe, for Tony Lopez, I mean, again, The man's been in there over 90 times as a pro fighter. And for Spivak to get a win over him 2 years ago with WWFC, that's a good win. It is a quality win.
It is. And I got to be honest, I think the size of Jared Vandera is actually going to be a big detriment in this fight. Sergey Spivak does one thing that really takes advantage of his opponent's immense size, if you will. That's single leg takedowns. And there's a reason that Daniel Cormier really only uses single legs, especially at heavyweight and light heavyweight. The bigger you are, the harder it is to balance on that one leg. Now, if you are dealing with like a Marcin Tybura type, size-wise and the physicality, he'll be able to sort of bear on you and get the leg free. But with a guy like Jared Vandera, I do see Sergey Spivak fishing for that single leg, really making him tired. And as the fight progresses, Spivak is one of the few guys at heavyweight who is fresh for three rounds. He does have a pretty good output. And in the Carlos Felipe fight, he rallied in that fight. It was very close for the first two rounds. And the third round, it wasn't even close. And he completely dominated a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt on the mat. And to me, that was a very impressive performance by Spivak. Maybe not against the most impressive opponent, but I did really like his performance in that one. So may have given away who my pick is a little early, but that's definitely where I'm leaning.
If we look at the odds, Matt, I actually think that they're insane. I think the opening odds made a lot more sense, but right now Sergey Spivak, a -228 favorite, open at a -145. If you look at Jared Vandera, he's right now a +184, opened up at a +125. Over on Tapology, out of 535 total votes, 84% going Spivak, 51% going submission. I would not feel all that confident in that pick. I mean, I will agree. I'm going with Sergey Spivak. You just have to make a case for both guys because, again, with Jared Vandera, he's got a wrestling base. He's got a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He's coming out of a camp and a pedigree that's bred a lot of really good wrestlers and a lot of guys with staying power. I do worry about the amount of punishment that he takes on the feet, though. And if you look at Jared Vandera's overall record and the guys that he's fought, it's pretty weak. I mean, you look at the Tony Lopez win. That is good. We talked about it. Spivak finished him. Vandera beat him by decision. Harry Hunsucker, though, it was a layup of an opponent if I've ever seen one, and he really brought the fight to him. And if you look at his record, going into that one, Honeysucker beating guys 9-14, 15-7, 1-0, 2-5, pro debut. Like, he hadn't faced the best level of competition. You look at Vandera's losses just a year ago, Henan Fahea. I went and watched a bunch of Henan Fahea fights, got really excited about him. So maybe we end up seeing him in the UFC at some point. But the guys that he beat in EFC when he was a champ, I mean, Ricky Macholas at 7-7, Ruan Potts, UFC legend. He beat him at the time when he was kind of over the hill. And Elvis Moyo, who's 8-5. So again, that level of competition really hasn't been there. I do like the guys that Sergey Spivak has faced. I like the Sambo background. I like the fact that if this fight gets into a clinch, I have a lot more confidence in a guy like Sergey Spivak with the upper body throws that he's going to be able to have. And you talked about it. He has a great single leg. Bringing all of those things together into an MMA fight, I really do favor the younger fighter in this one. So I will side ever so slightly with Sergey Spivak. But to me, this is a push or a pass on my card, if anything.
So I do agree with you. I like the odds a lot more when they open. Although I am picking Spivak, the fact that he's -230 doesn't make any sense, really. It will be an interesting fight because, again, Vandera does have the wrestling, and we could see him try to take down Spivak, but I do see it once the fight hits the mat, when it comes to the overall grappling of both guys, I just trust Spivak a lot more. I know that if he is going to go for the ground and pound, it might open up submissions, whereas for Vandera, he might just keep on pounding away, and it could even be a detriment. He could gas himself out, and against one of the more, it's hard to say athletic, but I would say one of the more active, if you will, heavyweights who he does have a good output, he does have good footwork. You know Spivak's going to have that staying power through 15, and I like Spivak in this one.
We're going to update you here as far as this one's concerned. I mean, right now, Sergey Spivak, a -225 favorite at open, now a -229 as of Monday evening. And if you look at Jared Vandera, open a +190, now at a +183. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, might not be to anyone's surprise. 784 total votes, 87% going with Spivak, 45% by decision, 37% by submission. So if we're giving our final takeaways here, I mean, really gave Sergey Spivak a lot of props for not just the cardio. He's not one of those giant heavyweights. Again, Jared Vandera could have a great deal of success if he can stuff some of those early takedown attempts. But Sergey Spivak, a known Sambo practitioner and a guy that really has that staying power, especially with the wrestling. So For me, I'm sticking with the pick of Sergey Spivak. What are you thinking here?
I like Spivak in this fight. He really only loses to, I hate to say, the upper echelon, but most of his losses are only to those top 15 guys in the UFC. It is really hard to beat a guy like Sergey Spivak. He's just so well-rounded. He's got great top control, and he's been in there with some of the best in the division, so I agree. I like Spivak.
Matt, you know that Tony Lopez is sitting at home watching this fight, but yeah, we're both going with Moldova Sergey Spivak. You don't get to hear Moldova mentioned enough in MMA, but there you go. To the people of Moldova, we thank you. So, Matt, we have a great card coming up this weekend. Of course, headlined by Curtis Blaydes taking on the Black Beast, Derek Lewis. You're going to want to keep it locked in for that and more. And as we always say, Matt, with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Big time banger at Bantamweight. We have Canada's Amin Zahabi taking on Draco, the great Dracolini Rodriguez. Matt, we previewed this fight in great detail not that long ago, really going in depth as to Draco Rodriguez's beginnings and his entrance into the UFC. And for Canada's Amin Zahabi, well, unfortunately, he was the reason that this fight fell apart in the first place. It was a COVID test the week of the fight on his way down to the States. So finally, we get this fight. We're going to head back into the past for the prediction of the future. Really looking forward to our next fight at Bantamweight. And we have a UFC debut for Draco, the great Dracolini, or Dracolini Rodriguez, taking on Amin Zahabi. Matt, for Amin Zahabi, it has been a minute since we've seen him in the UFC. And I had to go back and watch all of the UFC tape on him because, hey, it's been, what, 4 years, almost 5 years since he was on the regional scene. And for Amin Zahabi on the Canadian regional scene, went 6-0, all six wins by first-round finish, three of them by knockout, three of them by submission. At a time, he was a brown belt in jiu-jitsu. He's since upgraded. He's a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And in the three UFC fights, just so happened, Matt, that we were there for his UFC debut in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. Brian Stann, Todd Grisham on the call for that one. And in that fight, Amin Zahabi, it was a really good fight. It was against Vieira. And with Reginaldo Vieira, he won the Ultimate Fighter Brazil Season 4. I know he got knocked out in the quarterfinals, came back, won. And he had this fight against Zahabi where they really marketed the Canadian, the fact that his brother's, of course, Faraz from TriStar. He's a really technical fighter. And if you go back and watch that fight, when Zahabi had his most success, it was crashing forward. It was always setting things up with his left leg when he's from the orthodox stance. He'll switch to southpaw, but the weird thing is, he doesn't throw a lot when he goes southpaw. It's almost to just close distance and offer a different look, but it's not like he really pumps the jab out there. It does a whole lot with it. It's just to throw something different. So in that fight against Vieira, he wins it. I had scored at 29-27 for Zahabi. Then you look at his next fight, UFC 217 on the prelims, taking on Ricardo Ramos. And Matt, you think about that fight, you think about the finish, but before that, Zahabi was having a lot of success in that fight.
It is always odd when you look at a fighter and you try to think, okay, where did they fight their best fight? Well, for Amin Zahabi, he fought his best fight in a loss. And not just a loss. It was one of the more vicious knockout losses you'll ever see. Because he gets, like, double spinning elbow. Not something you see all that often in the UFC. It was very strange, though. And Amin Zahabi fights like he's playing Dance Dance Revolution. His feet never stop moving. He is always doing something with his feet, whether that is switching stances. He does do a lot of in-and-out movement. Not exactly like a Dominic Cruz, but he does try to send you a lot of feints, and he doesn't always throw punches to do so. In the Ramos fight, he did well on the feet. He was using really good clinch work. And the real key for Amin Zahabi is when he lets his combinations go, he does have really good success. Because we saw it kind of similar to a Gavin Tucker last weekend, where when he was throwing in combination, he was having a lot of success. Maybe the first two would land on the arms, but then that would open up the third strike. And with Amin, he has a very similar game plan where he is going to dart in, throw his combination, try to get out of distance. He can get caught, though, and we have seen that before. Sometimes he will try to extend the combination if he thinks he is landing well, and he is susceptible to the counter on that, and that worries me a little bit against a guy like Draco Rodriguez, who does have big power at this weight class. And for Zahabi as well, just last point, he is good at wrestling, but I wish he did more of it. Again, we talk about his jiu-jitsu credentials. It's not like he's a fighter who goes out there and really tries to get the fight to the mat constantly. If it does end up there, he is more than happy to oblige, but it's very odd that a guy who does have such a good grappling acumen doesn't actively use it in more MMA fights.
I think Draco Rodriguez is going to bring it to him in that way, and that's why I think this fight is a lot more competitive than the odds. And then at the same time, you look at Zahabi, he's been off for, what, almost a year and a half? And that's the thing. you look at his, you know, his pro career so far. One fight in 2012, two in 2014, two in 2015. Then he fights once in 2016, twice in 2017, then 2019, then 2020. It's been a lot of inactivity. And I went back and read an article and a bit of an interview that he did with Aldeas up here in Canada, which is the French language arm of TSN, which is our Canadian version of ESPN, to make that complicated for anybody that's not a Canadian or French language speaker. But the crux of the interview that he did was the fact that, A, it sucks that I've been off for so long. B, I'm on the call sheet and I keep accepting fights, but guys turn me away. And he's not really in a position to take fights because he's lost two in a row. And the other thing about Ayman Zahabi is that, and they've said this on broadcast before, he's the type of guy, and we talked about this with Adrian Yanez, so same division, last week on This Week in MMA. Hey, do you watch a lot of tape on your opponents or do you trust the coaches? And he's like, well, I was on the regional scene, so there wasn't a lot of tape, but now I'm going to watch more of it, and I really incorporate it into the game plan with my coaches. For Zahabi, he's one of those guys that goes out and does a ton of film study, and it's almost like he over-prepares for fights, and I think that's a trouble of, well, my brother's Faraz, and I stay at the gym, and he talked about this in the interview too. Well, I make money during the day because I'm associated with the gym, so fighting's just kind of like out there. I wish I could fight more, but at the end of the day, I've got the gym. For Draco Rodriguez coming in here, this was a guy that got passed over, and I remember this story, at UFC 239. He was supposed to come in on short notice and take on Chito Vera, and King of the Cage wouldn't release him from his contract.
Unfortunate.
It was after he had fought Tony Gravely for the belt and had lost. It was after he got a win there. I want to say that was January 2019, and then he was looking forward to taking the fight against Chito on short notice. He was originally booked for a King of the Cage main event against Johnny Munoz Jr., who ended up in the UFC as well. That fight fell through. Then he ended up, he had one more fight with King of the Cage. At the time, the promoter and co-owner said, well, he's got four fights left in his contract. I know what the promoter is actually trying to do, and it's kind of weird, and you might not agree with me here, but Draco Rodriguez is young. I mean, the guy's only, what, 24 years old? The promoter wanted him to kind of grow in the promotion where he didn't have to take a fight way too soon. And I get it, but at the same time, if you're Draco Rodriguez, you're going to petition hard for that UFC debut. Unfortunately, he had to wait. He ended up taking a fight on Dana White's Contender Series this summer against Mauna Martinez. Got a first-round triangle choke. It was a wild fight. It was a fight that was pick'em odds. But I went back and watched a ton of Draco Rodriguez tape for this one. This guy's wild as f***. Like, you look at six of his seven wins are by finish. He has a 13-0 amateur record, which is insane. That's too much of an amateur career, if you ask me. That started when he was 19. And the fact that he has all these armbar wins, armbar, triangle choke, guillotine, what else? His first pro fight, another guillotine. He was a white belt in 2018. It's crazy how aggressive he fights. Now, the level of competition is a bit of an issue. Again, Mauna Martinez getting that win was a big deal. So credit where credit's due. And that has to happen. When you're a guy in the regional scene, you're beating the guys you should beat, then you go up on the big scene, you get a win like that on Contender Series, you get a contract. He deserved it. Kudos to him. UFC fans and you know, prospect fans have had their eyes on Draco Rodriguez for a while. I got to talk about that Tony Gravely fight, though.
Gravely!
So King of the Cage, territorial conflict back in 2018. He gets beat pillar to post by Tony Gravely. And listen, Tony Gravely's a good fighter. That was his last fight with King of the Cage. Then he went and dominated CES. Then he ended up in the UFC. But when he had that fight, his takedown defense wasn't great. He was fishing for submissions, but he got beaten on the ground all five rounds until he got finished at the end of the fifth. I worry about that a little bit, and he's still a little green, but overall, this guy's such a good prospect. His hands are great. His aggressiveness is awesome, and he doesn't give a damn about what belt color you have in jiu-jitsu. He is going to go full bore, balls to the wall, and that should make for a really interesting fight here against Zahabi.
Okay, I don't know if we can take a lot from the Gravely loss, because just Gravely doesn't fight at all like Ayman Zahabi. Gravely is a much more dominant wrestler than Ayman Zahabi, and again, I would love it if Ayman Zahabi fought like Tony Gravely. He probably had a ton of success because he is so good on the ground, but he's one of these guys who, I don't want to say he's fallen in love with his hands, but he is much more happy to get into a striking exchange than he is in the grappling, and it is a very curious case when you do have a guy who, belt-wise, he might not be as good as Zabin Zahabi, but in MMA, his grappling, I would say, at least rivals it, if not better, because he uses it a lot more. So I am very excited for if this fight does hit the mat. I'm really curious to see who has the advantage. The inactivity of Zabin Zahabi does really worry me. I would like to see him compete quite a bit more. He's a young guy who is improving, so it would be nice if he could get in there a little bit more often. I know he is, and you had mentioned it, he is kind of in that James Krause level where it's like, okay, I'm making money being a coach at a gym. Fighting's not the most important thing to me, but I still do like doing it. For Zahabi, it's just one of those things. If he was more active, I do think we would see more progression between every fight for him. And this fight is really hard to pick. I know you've got the odds up. They are quite close.
They're not really close. Sorry. They're stupid. So Draco Rodriguez opened a minus 185 favorite. That line dropped just about last week, early last week. He was a minus 230 at one point. It's coming back up. So right now he's minus 193. If we have a look at Zabin Zahabi, he opened a plus 160, went up as high as a plus 186. He's now at a plus 160 again. That line's moved all day towards Zabin Zahabi. If we look at the Tapology votes, they're just silly. 640 total votes, 81% going Rodriguez, 70% by decision. I think if Rodriguez can stay busy enough on the feet, can push a pace, and can stay on his bike for three rounds, he can get a win over Zabin Zahabi. If I didn't make a pick on this one, I'd feel pretty good because this is honestly one of the toughest fights to pick. Again, I went back and watched so many Draco Rodriguez fights against scrubs in the regional scene that I didn't really gain a whole lot out of it other than the fact that this guy is a great prospect. And I'm really looking forward to him fighting in the UFC. If he beats Zabin Zahabi, that's a huge feather in his cap. I've seen Zabin Zahabi have success like that. He was one of those guys that was the next great Canadian prospects when he made his debut. And then even after getting the win over Vieira. So for me, if Zabin Zahabi can, again, do what he did in the Hamosh fight, if he can at least throw that nice kick, push a bit of a pace, rush forward, try not to get caught, and as long as you don't get hit by some spinning stuff, he can rely on his grappling. Because I think if Draco Rodriguez takes down Zabin Zahabi, it's going to be weird. He hasn't faced a guy like Zahabi on the ground like that. I mean, yeah, Tony Gravely's a wrestler, so it's a different story. I'm slightly edging Rodriguez in this fight, but again, I would not be surprised if Zabin Zahabi won it whatsoever.
So I do agree, and for a lot of the variables that you have brought up, the movement of Zahabi is going to be really important in this fight. And as the fight progresses, he does tend to get more stationary. We saw that in the Hamos fight. He'll do really well, and he is good at staying active early on in the fight, but he will kind of settle in as the fight progresses, and that does worry me against a guy like Draco Rodriguez, because if Zahabi could stay on his bike thoroughly throughout the 15 minutes, it would be really hard for Draco Rodriguez to find him. But the fact that Zahabi will get a little stationary and plant his feet, I like the activity of Rodriguez, and like you had said, when the fight hits the mat, I'm not going to really predict anything, because who knows how it's going to go, but I do like Draco Rodriguez in this fight.
If this gets past a first round, then maybe I'd and this is going to kind of contradict what you said. I might slightly edge one guy over the other, so I'd like to see it pass one round, because with Zahabi, again, he can typically stay on his bike all right. In the fight that he had against Vieira tired, and he just started shooting just kind of like desperation takedowns by the third round. That's why Zahabi's takedown defense is so high. It's because of that one fight, because Vieira went 2 for 13. In his second fight against Hamosh, he kind of stayed on his bike, and again, second round was good. First round was all right. Third round, he was gaining until Hamosh did one spinning elbow. And Joe Rogan, it's been a long time since he's had some good commentary, but in that one, he goes, Hamosh is looking for the spinning back elbow. He's kind of loading up with his weight. And then he really landed it to the point where he knocked him out cold. And then, we didn't even talk about it, but the fight against Vince Murdoch, Murdoch just pressured him, switched stances, threw low kicks, really threw the kitchen sink at him, and just frustrated him overall. And you can tell Zahabi's a cerebral guy. In that interview with Al Deas, they talked about the fact that he's been reading a lot of psychology books, trying to be mind over matter, trying to really press a pace within himself to put on a good fight. So I'll be interested to see which Zahabi we get in this one. Now, as an update, as far as those odds are concerned, Draco Rodriguez opened a minus 204 average on best fight odds, kind of trending around a minus 190. If we look over at Canada's Zahabi, open a plus 167 now at a plus 157 or thereabouts. And if we have a look at the total Tapology votes, 749 of them, 82% going Rodriguez, 66% by decision. All I really have on this is what I had before, is the fact that Draco Rodriguez is incredibly wild. He takes tons and tons of risks. It usually ends up in a finish. If he's able to kind of bring his technique together, I think he could be a really interesting prospect in this division. And for Ayman Zahabi, hasn't won a fight in almost 4 years. It's 3 years and 11 months ago. We were there. That was the first UFC show we ever went to. Just kind of crazy to think that even in that fight that Zahabi had against Reginaldo Vieira, really close fight, the Hamosh fight, he had some success in that one before he got knocked out by a spinning back fist and then another spinning back fist. And then his last time out against Vince Morales, that one's tough, especially being in Canada for that fight. So overall take here, you still keeping the pick that you had before?
So I know I had Zahabi before. I like his movement, especially.
You had Rodriguez.
Oh, sorry. Well, okay, good, because I was going to say I am going to stick with Trico Rodriguez or switch my pick to Rodriguez. Again, you had mentioned he does take a lot of unnecessary risks, but against a guy like Ayman Zahabi, he's a good striker. He's not a powerful striker by any means. So even if you do leave yourself open with some of those big overhands and big hooks, Ayman might be able to catch you, but I don't think he can catch you hard enough to really make you pay for it. Should be an interesting fight. I wouldn't be surprised if Zahabi is able to get the win, but I'm going to go with Rodriguez.
Matt, both of us going with Draco Rodriguez, but definitely one that I would keep off my card because as far as those odds are concerned, Rodriguez at about a 2-1 favorite, not for me. So we'll see what happens in this one. A possible fight of the night on our cards. We're really looking forward to it. And we have a great card coming up. I mean, Ketlin Vieira taking on Yana Kunitskaya in the co-main event and your main event, Curtis Blaydes and Derek Lewis. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Really interesting fight at featherweight. We have the scrapper, Chaz Skelly, taking on pretty boy Jamal Emmers. Matt, for both of these guys, they've taken on some good fighters in the past. I mean, for Jamal Emmers, that was always a story. This is a guy that was just outside of the UFC. It was only a matter of time before we got to see him. He main evented LFA 81 against Rafael Barboza, punched his ticket to the UFC with a win there. He unfortunately lost split decision to Giga Chikadze. I went back, MMA decisions, didn't watch the fight, and it was a close one, but Giga just outpointed him in that one. I mean, I know the takedowns were definitely the story for Jamal Emmers. They were definitely the story for him against Vince Cachero, who came in on short notice. Originally, it was supposed to be Jamal Emmers taking on Movsar Evloev. And really, that's been kind of the story. He's supposed to take on Evloev. Evloev, out of that fight because of a motorcycle accident. Then he was supposed to take on, it was Timur Valiyev, rather. Valiyev out of that fight. So in steps Vince Cachero. And so he picks up a win there. He just kind of rinse and repeat, able to get the win there. And that's kind of the thing out of these pinnacle MMA guys. And I say that, but that's where you're going to find Jamal Emmers. But training with the likes of Darian Caldwell, you're going to see Bobby Green there as well. Like, a lot of guys that can get it done on the feet. But for Darian Caldwell, some of the best pure wrestling that we see in MMA in the lower weight classes. But again, for Jamal Emmers, win over Jay Cuchinello, Ciel Machado, who else? Chris Avila, you know, the guy that trains with the Diaz brothers, and we've called out in the past. He also has a win over Corey Sandhagen. So that's kind of the story on Jamal Emmers. And we'll get into the technique. But for Chaz Skelly, he's been in the UFC for the longest time. Came in from Bellator in 2014. Lose to Mirsad Bektik. Picks up wins over Tom Ninamaki, Sean Soriano, Jim Ehlers, Edmilson Souza. Loses to the damaged Darren Elkins. Picks up big wins. Listen, a 19-second win over Maximo Blanco. You go back and look at that guy's record. A little bit insane. And then he picks up a big win over Chris Gritsmacher, a fight that wasn't even close. It was all Skelly in that fight, using that All-American NAIA wrestling chops. And Chaz Skelly, really, I know he lost to Jason Knight. He had the no contest against Bobby Moffitt. Weird fights for a guy like Chaz Skelly. And then the fight against Jordan Griffin that was booked two different times. He picks up a decision win there. Probably really saved his standing in the UFC, and that's a great win to have, because if you're Chaz Skelly, his wrestling's great, and his jiu-jitsu's pretty good too, and those are two combinations that usually you have one, but you don't have the other. Chaz Skelly has both. He's a really lanky guy for the division, kind of wonky striker, so this makes for a great fight, because I wouldn't say clash of styles, but these guys do fight in differing styles.
Oh, 100%, and I'm really excited for this fight. Chaz Skelly is a really interesting case because I know what he does well, but I also don't really know what he does well. Yes, he can wrestle. He has good jiu-jitsu. His striking's very awkward just because he can throw quite a bit of volume. He does have that kind of odd upright BJ Penn the third time he fought Frankie Edgar style, where he is just very, I don't know. He's got way too good a posture for my liking. But anyways, the Jason Knight fight's the one that I always go back to because that was just an awful late stoppage. And Chaz Skelly ate a lot of damage in that fight. And the other weird thing, too, about Skelly, you forget how long he's been in the UFC for. Like, I always think of Chaz Skelly, like, oh, he's been around for, like, you know, he's had 3, 4, maybe 5 fights in the UFC. No, he's been in the UFC for 5, 6 years now. He's been a veteran. He's been in there with some good guys. And you look at his losses. Yeah, he lost to Jason Knight. People only remember Jason Knight now, I guess, for being the guy who fought Artem Lobov and bare knuckle. But he had a nice little run in the UFC for a while. And then Darren Elkins, the damage who we all know and love. So Chaz Skelly struggles with the guys who do the things that he does well. He struggles with other guys who can wrestle. He struggles with other guys who are good at jiu-jitsu because then they can just force the fight to be a striking exchange. And for Jamal Emmers, we all know how good his wrestling is, how good his grappling is. But the easiest path to victory for Emmers in this fight might just be to keep it standing because he has the one who has the wrestling defense in his back pocket. For Skelly, he will kind of give up the takedown just to have the fight be on the mat. You don't want to be on your back against a guy like Jamal Emmers. I know he has good jiu-jitsu, but the ground and pound of Emmers is not something that you really want to be messing around with and really testing your jiu-jitsu out against. So for Emmers, if you can just defend a lot of the takedowns of Skelly, I'm not saying Skelly has bad striking by any means, but compared to the striking of Jamal Emmers, I just don't know how much success he's going to be able to get on the feet.
Yeah, it's going to be a really weird fight because that's the thing. For Jamal Emmers, when he fights poor wrestlers, well, he's able to get the takedown quite easily. He's able to gain top position and really land a lot of shots. And that's the thing for Jamal Emmers. He's one of those guys that might just kind of bully his way into position and then just start landing blows. For Chaz Skelly, he's going to take you down. He's going to get the back. He's going to try and get into a submission position. And again, if you look at some of those wins, Souza, rear naked choke. Tom Ninomaki, rear naked choke. You look at the fight against Blanco, Anaconda, and a rear naked against Chris Grützmacher. Again, he just kind of had his way in that fight. The fight against Bobby Moffitt that ended up in no contest, that was controversial as it was. So it was a really weird fight. It's one of those ones that, do you put a lot of stock into it? I think, again, the win that he had over Jordan Griffin's a great one because Griffin is that classic, again, kind of a mirror to Chaz Skelly. Is his striking great? Not so much. Is his takedown, you know, offense great? Well, it's not too bad. His submissions are really his bread and butter. So for Chaz Skelly, again, if you look at the overall body of work, he's got a couple wins over Daniel Pineda from back in the day, a win over Ray Trujillo that we all know and love. So a good base, and again, 10 submission wins on the record for Chaz Skelly. For Jamal Emmers, 7 by knockout, 3 by submission. Let's have a look over at the odds, Matt. Skelly opened a plus 120 underdog. He's now at a plus 186. If you look at Jamal Emmers, opened at a minus 140. He's now minus 232, which is absolutely insane. Again, this is one of those fights that I probably leave off of my card because I don't really love Jamal Emmers being that big of a favorite. But we have a look at the Tapology votes. We'll round this one out, see what the fans are thinking. Well, that's why we do this, Matt. This is a toss-up. 758 total votes, 64% Skelly, and 69% by decision. I always find that interesting early on that the odds are going in favor of Jamal Emmers like a landslide all of a sudden. They just continue to pour in for Jamal Emmers from a betting perspective. But the fans are going with Chaz Skelly. What's your take here?
I like Emmers in this fight. I really do. And it's nothing against Skelly, but when we do bring up that Jordan Griffin win, for me, Jordan Griffin's a great win to have in your first UFC fight, your second UFC fight, when you are still quite early on in your career. Jordan Griffin's the type of guy who we point to. It's like if when Alexander Volkanovski was making his way towards the title, and you're like, oh, he fought Darren Elkins on his way up. Like, there's certain guys that you just like to see on someone's record. Jordan Griffin's one of those guys. The difference is Chaz Skelly's not in his first kind of little run in the UFC. He's an established name, and the fact that he is fighting at that sort of Jordan Griffin level still at this point in the UFC is a little concerning. It's not that Jamal Emmers is going to be a top 15 forever, but I do think Jamal Emmers has a serious ceiling at 145. The fight against Chikadze was weird. It was really close. He did have the takedown. Chikadze, which struck him. But those are the types of fighters that Emmers can have close fights with, and I just think his stock and Chikadze's stock, for that matter, to be a little bit higher than Skelly. So I'll agree, the odds should probably be a little bit closer, but I do like Emmers in this fight.
Yeah, I mean, you say closer, but people keep gambling on him.
That's true.
That's kind of the thing. And if you look at Jamal Emmers again, you look at some of the names that he was supposed to be match up with against. Alexander Hernandez on an early way up. You look even recently, again, Derek Minner, Mazar Evloev, Timur Valiyev. Like, that's the kind of stock you put in this guy. And yeah, he's winning fights before that, so it's not like, oh, well, let's just throw Jamal Emmers in there. It's going to be a loss. I'm sure he would have been an underdog in the Evloev fight, but I do like him in this one as well because, again, his takedown defense isn't terrible. His offense is quite good from that respect. But if it's a fight that keeps standing on the feet
as they say, every fight starts on the feet. I think Jamal Emmers has more than a good opportunity in this one. So I'm going with pretty boy Jamal Emmers. You're in agreement on this one.
Oh, yeah.
Looking forward to it because maybe Chaz Skelly proves everybody wrong, takes him down and submits him. Wouldn't that be an interesting wrinkle of a development and all the Tapology voters be right? So I'm really looking forward to this fight. It should be a great card. Your headliner rebooked. If Curtis Blaydes taking on Derek Lewis, we're really looking forward to that one. And as we always say, Matt, Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Really interesting fight on our preliminary card. We have Danger, Shayna Dobson, coming off of one of the biggest underdog wins in MMA history. She was roughly a plus 950 underdog, taking on Maria Agapova, who was on a good streak. She had, what, 3 wins in a row? The Hannah Cyphers win in her debut. She looked amazing. Kazakhstan was on the map. And then Agapova came out super confident, blew her wad in the first, what, half of the first round.
That was bad.
And then after that, had nothing left. And Shayna Dobson, credit to her, has really good cardio, staying power, and decent enough boxing and wrestling to where she got herself out of a bad position, bullied her way on top, and just pummeled poor Maria Agapova. So you have Shayna Dobson coming into this one. She bucked that trend of 3-fight losing streak, which has really been the story of 2021, let alone Shayna Dobson's 2020. And if you look opposite her, I don't know what Bobby Green thinks about Casey O'Neill, but you're coming after my nickname. We have King Casey O'Neill making her UFC debut. She's 5-0 so far. She was the type of fighter that really smartened up. And listen, she's originally from Scotland, moved at a young age to Australia. Her father, Cam O'Neill, you might know that name, former pro kickboxer. He's the promoter and owner of Eternal MMA, where you saw Casey fight in some of her earlier fights. But Casey, she traveled over to the UAE Warriors promotion her last time out. She picked up a really big win over Christina Stelliou. And she was 6-3 at the time, Stelliou was. And O'Neill looked pretty good in that fight. I mean, you got to give credit where credit's due. Threw a nice low kick, really mixed up the combinations on the feet. But it was really the work that she did on the ground that was able to win out in that one. Again, you get a win by TKO over there. UAE Warriors, UFC was at Fight Island. You get the trend. And she had kind of a bug in Mick Maynard's ear. Got her opportunity in the UFC. But originally it wasn't supposed to be against Shayna Dobson. I went back and watched an interview with Low Kick MMA's friend of the show, James Lynch. And when he talked with Casey O'Neill, she said that she was supposed to have a fight against Lucky Lauren Murphy. Signed the contract. She was going through the old COVID protocols, tested positive, didn't feel any symptoms. So they at least kept her around because you've seen fighters kind of come in on short notice. They can't fight. And then it's like, okay, well, you know, you probably need more time to develop anyway. We'll give you that opportunity. But for Casey O'Neill, she gets this opportunity against Shayna Dobson. Cross-training between Extreme Couture and 10th Planet. She's representing Scotland and Australia. So I threw that one down there in the description. You're probably going to see a lot of Scotland. I think she called herself like a Skazi in a couple of different interviews that I read about. So hopefully I didn't butcher that. But Skazi? I mean, we're from the Commonwealth too, Matt.
You mention it a lot.
You look at this fight. And for Casey O'Neill, again, she's got a little bit of the kickboxing in her back pocket. She's got a little bit of wrestling, a little bit of jiu-jitsu. Her wrestling defense isn't all that great, but opposite her, Shayna Dobson, you're not going to believe this because, again, I put these stats up if the fighters have had 3 UFC fights, and for Casey O'Neill, she hasn't, so that's why I don't have it for Shayna Dobson. 0% takedown defense so far in the UFC. 0% takedown defense. So this is where I'm going to set this one up, Matt, and then I'll let you tee
it off.
Please do. Casey O'Neill does not have good takedown defense. Shayna Dobson's takedown defense, non-existent. Her offense isn't terrible. She's a decent wrestler, and she has all right boxing combinations. I mean, she got pieced up by Priscilla Cachueta, but they were both going at it. Cachueta landed a nice right hand.
You're
going to
get knocked out by Priscilla.
The zombie girl's going to knock you out sometimes. Shayna Dobson, good cardio. Casey O'Neill, slippery on the ground. If this fight is a striking bout, it's really tough to try and cap. I do not love the fact that Casey O'Neill is closing in on a 2-1 favorite. That kind of scares me like a lot. So what do you make of this one?
Not a lot of defense in this fight. That's one of the few things I can guarantee. Like you had said, neither fighter has great takedown defense, but both fighters can wrestle offensively. You've seen takedown attempts from both of them. And for Shayna Dobson, listen, I've given her a rough time on this podcast, and I'm going to do it a little bit more, but then I'm going to say some positives. I really am.
Well, first of all, apologize to her.
I will. She did great against Agapova. Now, I was not nearly as high on Agapova as the man sitting to my right, but still, I did not think she had a chance at all to win that fight. So, good job, Shayna Dobson. Here's the problem. Her only two UFC victories. Now, crazy thing. She is tied with the champ Valentina Shevchenko for most TKO KO wins in the division's history with two. But those two wins, her opponent just gave up in both of them. And I don't feel unjustified in saying that. With Agapova, she beat Maria. It was just Agapova gave up. She had no cardio whatsoever in that fight. And the second she got stuck on bottom, she just couldn't get back up to her feet and got TKO'd that way. So, again, it is a TKO win. But I look at that less as Dobson won that fight than Agapova lost that fight.
But, Matt, what about her other TKO win?
Oh, don't worry. And I am so happy I can talk about this fight because I gotta admit, I've never been the biggest Ultimate Fighter fan, but when Justin Gaethje and Eddie Alvarez were the coaches, I was like, well, goodness, I'm excited for this. They were introducing a new weight class. So I was like, okay, fine. I'm gonna actually sit down and watch this season of The Ultimate Fighter. And they finally get to the finale. They're fighting for the title. You got Roxanne versus Nico Montano, ex-champion. You may or may not have known that. And Shayna Dobson fought Ariel Beck on that card. Because, you know, it is popular. What they'll do is if you have two fighters in The Ultimate Fighter, maybe they both lost. They didn't make it to the finals. The UFC will sign them and they'll match them up on that kind of, you know, it'll be a card. Maybe it's on a Thursday night. They've always got it on a weird night. Shayna Dobson lands a clean punch. Don't get me wrong. Ariel Beck lands a punch of her own and then just kind of, like, takes three steps back and curls up on the cage. And it's the strangest reaction I think I've ever seen to a punch. She reacts kind of like how Rory McDonald did when Robbie Lawler smashed his nose. The difference was that's one of the greatest fights of all time, and both guys took untold amounts of damage. And in this fight, she just kind of ate a right hand and got into the fetal position. So Dobson's wins are just really weird. And for Casey O'Neill, you look at her level of competition, it's not great. And something we always say here is when you haven't fought the greatest level of competition, it doesn't matter how you've gone out and beaten them. And there are a lot of decisions on Casey O'Neill's record. Here's the problem, and yes, there's always a big red flag, especially when you have been fighting people with negative records of the O&Os of the world, but I can't say that Casey O'Neill doesn't have any wins that are as good as Shayna Dobson's wins. Like, yes, Dobson has beat Ariel Beck. That is a UFC win, if you will. She beat Agapova. That is a UFC win. But you just kind of look through her record. Other than those two fights, they fought very similar levels of competition.
And that's the thing. I mean, you look at Shayna Dobson as a pro. Cassandra Spatz, you won that fight by decision. You lose to Nico Montano. Okay. Well, I know a lot of people don't like Nico the person, but Nico the fighter, not terrible. She's not terrible. She's not terrible.
All right.
So you lose the decision to her. You beat Rebecca Adney. You get into the Ultimate Fighter. You lose to Roxanne Modafferi. So then you go out there and you beat Ariel Beck. You lose to Lauren Mueller in a fight that was, close?
It was, but here's my issue. Lauren Mueller, if you lose to her, then we really need to have a conversation.
Okay, but it was a close enough fight. She got pieced up by Sabina Mazzau, and that fight wasn't close whatsoever. And then she got finished by Priscilla Cachoeira. So three-fight losing streak in two fights where you lost and you got pieced up in a decision, and you lost in a first-round knockout. You're having success boxing until you get knocked out 40 seconds in, so take that for what it's worth. And then you got Maria Agapova, where she looked good. Like, she didn't look terrible. Agapova threw the kitchen sink at her early. Dobson was able to withstand it, and then just due to the fact that she's tough as nails, she was able to get the finish herself. And listen, I mean, she had Agapova's arm down, and she was hammering away, but Agapova was pretty much, like, down for the count, and it was over. For Casey O'Neill, if you look at that level of competition, she has 1, 2, 3, 4 fights with Eternal, where your dad's a promoter. All right, so there's that. And you look at the way, again, you're right, you look at the way she's winning. 1-1 was her debut. That makes sense. That happens on the regional scene. You win a decision. You beat Jada Kelty. Again, it was Jada's debut. First round rear naked choke. You beat Miki Matono by decision. We went back and watched that fight. Miki Matono fought pretty well in that one, too.
It was an awful fight, to be completely honest. And that's the weird thing, too. You bring up O'Neill, how her dad is such a good kickboxer, and that is sort of her background. But you see a lot more grappling out of her fights than you do her own striking, and that's what makes me worry for Shayna Dobson.
And that's the thing, too. You can kind of rag on Casey O'Neill's pro win. She's on a 10-fight win streak going back to her amateur days. That goes all the way back to 2017, and it was finish. So all five of those amateur fights finish wins. And then as a pro, she has 2 of her 5 total wins by finish. She got the win over at UAE Warriors 13. Just basically outdid Christina Stelliou all over the place. Like, Greece's Stelliou didn't really stand much of a chance in that one. So if we have a look at the Tapology votes, let's start there. 785 of them, 84% O'Neill, 81% by decision. If we have a look at the odds, like I said, O'Neill open to minus 185. Now at a minus 152. So I said early on, she's about a 2-to-1 favorite. That line is closing quickly. I mean, if you look at Shayna Dobson, the line's moved 21% to Dobson, who opened a plus 160, now at a plus 125. So again, for me, I look at O'Neil striking. Maybe needs a little bit of polishing. That's the other thing. I mean, she trained at Tiger Muay Thai extensively in Thailand. So she's had the Hickman brothers in her corner before. Her main training partner over there was Loma Lukbunmi. She spent some time with Piotr Jan. I know in one of the interviews that I, and I watched and read a lot of about Casey O'Neil before this one, was the fact that didn't really get a chance to train with Valentina Shevchenko. She zigs when everybody else zags, more or less. You've seen that of any of those Shevchenko sisters, like the time they trained in Brunswick, Maine. And if you look at her now, she went over to the States, Extreme Couture, 10th Planet. You have to think that that's going to go to her advantage. For Shayna Dobson, she used to be a Team Lloyd Irvin fighter. She's been with Elevation for, almost a couple of years now.
And been a while.
Finally showed some dividends out there the last time against Agapova. So for me, I guess it makes sense where the line is. You know, a 2-to-1 for O'Neil coming in here against a fighter that's 4-4 in Shayna Dobson makes a bit of sense. If you're putting any money on this one, you're insane. Like, you're insane. I wouldn't have this on any card whatsoever. Maybe you wait until after the first round. What's the final take here, Matt?
I like Casey O'Neil in this fight. Listen, Shayna Dobson, I've seen her not lose two UFC fights. I haven't seen her win two UFC fights. And I know that's a weird way to say it, but it's true. Ariel Beck just straight up gave up against her. And so did Maria Agapova. And for Casey O'Neil, I've at least seen her go for the win in her career. And here's the thing with Dobson. She is a good striker, but she needs power to get any of her nice strikes off. And she relies on her power a lot. Look at the Priscilla Cachoeira fight. If she does really try to sit down on her shots, she leaves herself extremely open for counters. It's not that O'Neil has crippling power by any means. I don't think O'Neil's going to win by TKO. But I do just think that the steady output of O'Neil and the takedowns will be enough to win a decision. I think O'Neil can wrestle as well as Agapova did in the first round of her fight against Dobson. I just don't think O'Neil will get tired like Agapova did.
I don't want to be overly critical. I want to be a nice guy. You know, again, Canadians, Commonwealth. I don't love Casey O'Neil in this fight. I don't love either one of them.
That's right? It. We have to give a pick.
To be 100% confident, like, this would be one that if I could leave it off a card, I would. Because I don't feel confident picking either one of these women. For Casey O'Neil, she throws leg kicks, but when she throws the kick, she backs up. And then she kind of, like, freezes for a second. And her combinations are kind of like Cindy Dandois a little bit. So it just leaves a lot to be desired. I know she's a good prospect. She's undefeated and such. So I will slightly side with Casey O'Neil in this one. But, you're going to have to come back to question mark kicks. We'll see what the week does. And maybe I switch over to Shayna Dobson. But, Matt, no confidence in this pick at all.
I think Casey O'Neil's got this one in the bag. I got to be honest. Shayna Dobson has not shown me any positives throughout her UFC career up to this point. Make whatever reactions you want, Craig. She had a really nice win in her last one. But again, you beat a fighter who gave up. You didn't go out there and you beat that fighter. That fighter got tired and got into a position they couldn't get out of. I like O'Neil. I think she'll be able to out-wrestle herself in this one. Dobson can win this fight by decision. I just don't see it happening.
Dobson winning by decision, a definite possibility, but we're ever so slightly going with this. What was it? The Scottsdalian? The Scottish Australian. We're going with the Scotty and Casey O'Neil. Really looking forward to this card, Matt. Lots of great fights, including our main event between Derek Lewis and Curtis Blades. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. We have this one circled as a possible fight of the night. You have Juicy J, Julian Arosa, not featuring on Katy Perry songs and his own rap albums, taking on Nate the Train Landwehr. And Matt, for both these guys, interesting paths to the UFC. For Juicy J, he's kind of like Glenn Big Baby Davis. We're going to do a little bit with the Celtics. We're going to end up in, you know, the Southwest. And then all of a sudden, in our neck of the woods, in St. John, New Brunswick, Canada. For Juicy J, three different stints with the UFC, overall total record of 2-4. And while you might think that is full of salt, you're right. He won his last fight against Sean Woodson by outlasting Sean Woodson. I mean, Woodson, classic boxer, really, really thin legs, and Juicy J just kept cracking at those legs. We're just going to keep chopping the tree, and then eventually end up with a pretty neat submission, earning himself a performance of the night with a Darce choke in that one. He was a plus 350 to a plus 400 underdog in that fight. We had Woodson. A lot of people had Woodson. It was a great win for Juicy J, and if you look at his last five fights, even the losses are against good fighters. I mean, Devontae Smith, Grant Dawson, and then Julio Arce. I mean, I'm probably the biggest Julio Arce fan in the world. Great fighter. So you end up with a Rosa outside of the UFC. He beats AJ Bryant. Isn't that a WWE guy? I think it is. Ugh, correct me in the comments. For Nate Landwehr, went on a huge win streak, former M1 global champ. He was doing great things over there. Listen, like, was he ever going to fight Movsar Evloev? I know they were two different weight classes, but they always seemed to be on the same card. Like, it was Evloev, Landwehr, M1 champs. And then he comes over to the UFC and he takes on one of the Burns brothers. And it's not the Burns brother that just lost the welterweight title. It's the other Burns brother, Herbert. And he gets finished emphatically in that one. And then Nate Landwehr comes back with his classic, I just cut my hair in my basement haircut. And he fights Darren Elkins in a fight between old Darren Elkins and a guy that fights like a young Darren Elkins. And it was amazing. But of course, Darren Elkins, just like Nate Diaz in 2019, his face will evade him. And it just started to fill up. It started to blow up. And the cuts really caused an issue for Darren Elkins in that one. I mean, it was kind of a gruesome look for him. But Elkins stayed in that fight. Like, even into the third round, he was going at it with Nate Landwehr. Landwehr is a showy guy. I mean, he's like Patrick Roy when he wanted to leave Montreal. Like, he'll put his hands way up in the air, like, trade me. He'll kind of put his hands behind his back. Like, he'll do a lot of herky-jerky weird stuff, which could definitely get him in trouble against a lot of different strikers. Matt, we love this fight. Why do you love this
fight? This is a really fun fight because you know Nate Landwehr is going to bring the fight to Julian Erosa. And for Erosa, listen, the one problem that he does have, and yes, he's only lost two fairly good fighters, he doesn't deal with range very well. He is one of those guys, listen, he's 6'1", but he weighs 145 pounds. It is absolutely absurd how he weighs in at 145. And he does have sort of that Max Holloway kind of body type. The difference is, he doesn't deal with those pressure fighters all that well. He can get pinned up against the cage. He does have a certain strength disadvantage in this weight class. And against a guy like Nate Landwehr, we do talk about the excitement that his fights bring. But also, Nate Landwehr, if he wants to, since he does have decent wrestling, can make this a boring fight and hold Erosa up against the cage. Now, I'm not going to predict this is a boring fight by any means, because I really do think this is going to be one of the more exciting fights of the night. But Landwehr and the pressure that he brings is going to force Julian Erosa to either A, start throwing a boatload of knees up the middle, or do what we see a lot of guys do when they get their back up against the cage, shoot for his own takedowns. And that's really what's interesting about this fight. Both guys, yes, they've had their losses here and there, but both guys are good on the ground, on the feet, and in the clinch. And they're going to offer the other guy a lot of different looks and wrinkles. For Erosa, he does have that really nice darce choke and really just head and arm chokes from any position. Because we talk about the disadvantages of being that tall, thin frame. There are some advantages as well. And for those head and arm chokes, when you're built like Erosa, you can just get those angles no matter where. And if we do see, let's say Nate Landwehr is doing really well. He's pressuring Erosa. And then he gets clipped by a big shot and he does shoot from one of those panic takedowns against the cage. We've seen it 1,000 times before. Julian Erosa's guillotine, his darce choke, his anaconda can really threaten anyone at this weight class. And I do think when you look at the record of Erosa, it doesn't really give him as much credit as it should. Listen, he's been in the UFC 3 times, and you're probably thinking, well, you've got to be pretty bad to get cut from the UFC 2 times and then be brought back. But no, he only has fought a really high level of competition, and he always brings out the best in his opponent. Yes, Devontae Smith beat him really, really fast, but other than that isolated fight, they are normally very competitive fights throughout. And I think this would be extremely exciting. For Nate Landwehr, though, I think his output could get him in trouble in this fight. We do see him just throw. And at some point, Julian Erosa is great at outlasting his opponents. And I do fear a little bit for Landwehr that if he is throwing that crazy amount of volume that we know him for, could he just tire himself out? And then could Erosa kind of bring it back in that third round?
And I mean, for Julian Erosa, too, you talk about the level of competition, even outside of the Ultimate Fighter Season 22, where he got knocked out in the first round by Artem Lobov. Yikes. Holy smokes. You were fighting decent level of competition. I know even on that season, a win over Jason Soares, who the UFC did not want to sign in that episode of looking for a fight, where he had Rafael Alves, that's earlier on this card. He had a win over Mehdi Bagdad, you know, All-Stars MMA's own, and a win over Abner Lavares by split decision. But you look at it after that, a win over Marcin Rocek in the finale, former KSW champ at 45. He lost to Taruto Ishihara, a little bit late in Ishihara's career, if you ask me. But lost to Taruto, that'll happen. I guess at the time, 7-2-2. Win over Austin Springer, that you know and love. I mean, he fought on Contender Series in the UFC, lost to Paddy Pimblett, and the story goes on. He punched his second ticket to the UFC with a win over Jamal Emmers on Contender Series. And if you look at Nate Landwehr, again, it might not be a lot of names that the MMA fan might know over in North America. But, I mean, Viktor Kolesnik, big decision win there. Andrei Leshnev, that he had at M1 Challenge 95 against Khamzat Dalgiev. That was the one that really got me on the Nate Landwehr train because, of course, like I said earlier, You had Mav Zaryev-Layev on that card, but Nate Landwehr picked up a big win. That was Battle of the Mountains, Battle of the Mountains 7, and a really awkward scene when Nate Landwehr won that fight, because it was like, no, he wasn't supposed to win that fight, but he did. You look at the losses, I mean, listen, it's regional scene losses 5 years ago plus. So Nate Landwehr, he's won good fights, he's a pressure fighter, he has good wrestling in his back pocket. For Juicy J, good leg kicks, good striking. He has at times left his hands low, and he's made himself susceptible to power shots, and so you could definitely see a path to victory for Nate Landwehr that way. We did see it from Juicy J the last time out against Sean Woodson. He did tend to keep his hands up a little bit higher, and you usually see fighters when they tire, the hands start to come down a little bit, but Julian Arosa kept them up. So in this fight, it'll be interesting to see which version of these two guys we get. Are we going to get the crazy Nate Landwehr that's out there for blood? Are we going to get the Juicy J that leaves his hands down? It's an interesting one. So if we have a look at the odds, Matt, again, Julian Arosa opened a plus 131. He's now at a minus 115. Nate Landwehr opened a minus 159 on best fight odds. Now at a minus 108. So the odds have reversed themselves. Over on Topology, you have a pretty decent sample size so far. 778 total votes, 75% Landwehr, 52% by decision, 41% by knockout. So the odds are telling a different story. People are putting their money on Julian Arosa. The fans, on the other hand, are voting with Nate Landwehr. What do you think about that?
So I'm going to side with the former betting favorite and the current fan favorite, if you will, in Nate Landwehr. Again, I do like the wrestling from Landwehr, and I do think he's at least well-versed enough on the ground to not get caught by anything from Julian Arosa. And for Landwehr, too, we talked about the hands of Arosa. The one thing he is guilty of, when he does think a takedown attempt's coming, he will drop his hands looking for a submission. And if Landwehr does, if he will be able to do kind of that classic Chad Mendes, fake the takedown, come up high for a big shot. Not that Landwehr has insane amounts of power and he's going to put Arosa down with one big shot, but just something to look out for as the fight does progress. I like Landwehr in this fight, but I will admit this is an absolute toss-up.
It's really weird how Nate Landwehr beat Darren Elkins. That seems like only yesterday he was a top-ranked fighter. You beat Darren Elkins, and then you fight Julian Arosa. To me, it's almost going backwards. And for Arosa, he picked up that big win over Sean Woodson his last time out. Nate Landwehr, probably the perfect opponent, I would think. I mean, really, it's not too much of a stretch. You were a big underdog, almost like Shayna Dobson, where she had the win over Agapova. And now you get a debuting fighter in Casey O'Neill. For Juicy J, he's been around the block. He gets this fight with Nate Landwehr. I will side, however, with Julian Arosa in this fight due to the fact that I like the availability of the submissions for him against a wrestler. I like his striking in this fight. I like that low kick. And if you look at Nate Landwehr, he tends to chase his opponents a lot. I mean, and again, he can because his wrestling's so good, but I do like Arosa and especially the staying power. Now, if Landwehr gets a finish, it's either really early or really late.
I would agree.
But I like Julian Arosa in this fight. So we'll differ on the picks. I'm going with Arosa. You're going with Nate Landwehr. Let us know which one of the two is crazy. I'm sure if you're Topology voter, I can already guess. But yeah, let us know what you're thinking about this fight. It should be a great one. And we got a great card coming up, of course, on your main card, your co-main event, Ketlin Vieira taking on Yana Kunitskaya. And in your main event, Curtis Blaydes taking on Derek Lewis. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Really interesting fight at bantamweight. We have the former WEC champ. He was an interim champ challenger, I guess you'd say, in the UFC. And Eddie Wineland, the guy loves his mustache, and so do I, taking on Sexy Maxi, John Castaneda, a guy who came into the UFC on relative short notice. He's taking on Nathaniel Wood. Unfortunately for John Castaneda, unable to get the win there. And really, if you look at his last five fights, maybe a little bit of a surprise that he ended up in the UFC. He had a two-fight losing streak. He ended up winning one over with Combate, took some time off, had the win over, like I said, Marcelo Rojo, the red guy. Arm triangle choke win there. Takes the time off, fights Nathaniel Wood, and it didn't go his way. And if you've watched John Castaneda fights, I know I was really excited for his fight against Nathaniel Wood. It was the fact that Castaneda, nice southpaw, throws pretty decent with his hands, and that's the thing. Like, doesn't have crazy volume. He has all right power. Like, technically, he's sound. Throws a nice low kick. He is all right wrestling. He can get himself into some trouble when he goes for his takedowns. He can get a little sloppy with it. But overall, a decent fighter. And at 29 years of age, a record of 17-5. Again, maybe a little bit of a surprise that this is a guy that the UFC took a flyer on. But if you watch that fight with Nathaniel Wood, the trouble for Castaneda was that he got out-volumed in that one.
He really did. And it's interesting because you try to parallel Eddie Wineland with Nathaniel Wood and just see what they do similar. They are fairly similar fighters, both primary strikers, of course. The main difference, though, is the hand speed. Nathaniel Wood, he is really good at darting in and out and throwing those really nice straight shots, especially going to the body and to the head. We've seen that throughout Nathaniel Wood's career. And here's the thing for Castaneda. Your first fight was against Nathaniel Wood in the UFC. If you lose to him, there is zero shame in that whatsoever. Nathaniel Wood, I know his nickname is the prospect of the future, and he hasn't really seemed to live up to that nickname. But he's still one of the better fighters at 135 and a really, really tough out. So losing to Nathaniel Wood in your UFC debut, there is no shame in that. And that fight was a lot closer than I had really assumed because, again, maybe I'm higher on Nathaniel Wood than most people are, I will admit. But to be able to go all three rounds and still have a fairly good account of yourself means something.
To me, John Castaneda's fight against Nathaniel Wood, and this is where I'll draw the parallel. Last week, when we were talking about Gabe Green's fight with Daniel Rodriguez, Gabe Green lost 30-27 on all the judges' scorecards. John Castaneda lost 30-27 on all the judges' scorecards, but he gave a decent account of himself. Like, again, southpaw striker, decent volume, but not as much volume as Wood. Same as Gabe Green when he took on Rodriguez, not enough volume. So you have a fighter in John Castaneda, like I said, only 29 years old, taking on the 36-year-old, he's halfway to 37, Eddie Wineland. And the last time we saw him out, he got finished by Sean O'Malley. And listen, the record out of their last five, it is the same. I look at the win that Eddie Wineland had against Grigory Popov. Now, full transparency, we always talk about, well, when a fighter comes over from WLF Wars in Southeast Asia, they're either really good or really bad.
Buyer beware.
That's a way too much of a generalization, but here's where it comes into effect. You look at Sumadergi, and you look at the way that, you know, he lost some fights, and he came into the UFC off a loss, and then he fights Luis Smolka, and he loses, and it's like, oh, okay, there's a lot of salt in that organization. And then he starts winning fights, and you're like, oh, okay, Sumadergi's a really good fighter. Well, Eddie Wineland fought Grigory Popov, who was a WLF guy making his UFC debut at 35, and you went, okay, well, what was Grigory's last win? Like, what was it like? Well, he beat a guy that was 2-2. Ooh, okay, well, maybe he's not that good. Listen, Grigory Popov stood in the pocket and traded with Eddie Wineland, and he kept throwing kicks, and then his face got bloody, and then his face started to blow up, and then Eddie Wineland just went full sicko mode and finished him in that fight. And he looked great. His combinations were great. His hands were low, as most Eddie Wineland fights are, and he looked like a smaller Cowboy Cerrone. So overall, I like the striking out of both of these guys. And if they decide that, you know, forget about the ground game, this should be a great fight.
Oh, 100%. And you say Cowboy Cerrone for Eddie Wineland. Joe Rogan likes to say that, oh, Eddie Wineland, if you just saw a silhouette of him, you'd know who it was because he fights so unique. I got to be honest. I think Eddie Wineland fights almost identical to Cub Swanson, especially in the way that he strikes. He does have that kind of old-timey hand placement where he does have his hand down by his hips, and he will put everything behind his shot knowing that it will put him out of position just trying to go for the knockout blow. And for Eddie Wineland, too, he is very boxing heavy, although he will throw some kind of sidekicks and whatnot to the leg. He does have a decent oblique kick. He is hittable, and that's the weird thing about Wineland. He's like Matt Brown at this stage in his career, and I have to be completely honest, Eddie Wineland is like my bantamweight Matt Brown. I love Eddie Wineland. I'm always excited for one of his fights. Win, lose, or draw, you're always going to get something extremely exciting out of an Eddie Wineland fight, and I just remember him from fighting like Henan Barat way back in the day as the co-main event to Jones Gustafson. But Wineland is going to get hit in this fight, and he's going to hit Castaneda, and that really comes down. That's the big question I need to get answered in this fight. Who has the better chin? Because I know both guys are going to get cracked, and I know both guys are going to land as well. So for me, it comes down to who can be a little bit more elusive and who can also land their shots cleaner. So I really do think this fight's one of those, whoever's moving forward is going to be winning. And for me, I think Castaneda's kicks are going to give Wineland trouble. I do think that wide stance of Wineland. Listen, eventually, Wineland's going to get in one of those fights, and we haven't seen it yet, but you're going to see the old guy get just dominated by calf kicks. And we kind of saw that with Conor versus Poirier. I doubt we're going to see it in this fight, but we are going to see it one day, just Eddie Wineland get destroyed by calf kicks. I don't know if this is going to be that fight, but it is something that's probably on the near horizon that you should probably be looking out for.
Now, if you go back and watch Eddie Wineland's fight that he had, the win over Grigory Popov, at the end of it, he kind of said, well, I'm in the best shape I've been in. I'm like, I'm 10 years older, like I'm 25. And he did, like, he looked really good in that fight. And you look at the two losses before, John Dodson and Alejandro Perez. And I don't care, you know.
Ranked fighters at the top.
Yeah, I mean, Perez, we haven't seen him in forever, really. And John Dodson, again, some of the fastest hands at 135. He's a magician for a reason. The loss to Sean O'Malley, pretty tough one. It was quick, but it was tough. Like, he just kind of, like, walked in and See you later.
Anyone can get knocked out in the first minute of a fight, though, and that's just the truth.
And for Castaneda, again, he had a fairly competitive fight against Nathaniel Wood. I know he lost it. So let's look at the topology votes, Matt. 783 total votes, 72% going with Wineland, 71% by decision, the 28% that have Castaneda, 69% by decision. If we look at the odds, Eddie Wineland opened a -150 favorite. Now at a +100 for John Castaneda, opened a +130, now at a -125. Castaneda, the third biggest mover on the card at 38%. So the gamblers, again, disagreeing with the voters, which is always an interesting thing to see. What's your final take on this one?
So I've been going back and forth on this one. And again, the matchmaking on this card has been pretty good. There are a lot of really close fights. I like Castaneda in this one. I was siding with Wineland a lot, but again, the kicks I do think will give Wineland a little bit of issue. And the last time I saw Wineland out, again, he did get finished quite brutally in the first round. And I did see a bite on a lot of feints from O'Malley. Now, Sean O'Malley, just as a pure striker, other than his ankle health, I guess, is a phenomenal pure striker. It's not that Castaneda is going to be able to hit with the same accuracy or even the same power on his shots. It's just I think the holes are there from Wineland. I do think he will give you openings, especially in some of the striking exchanges. I'm going to pick Castaneda, although I will admit, if Eddie Wineland won by first round knockout, I wouldn't be surprised at all.
That's the thing. I mean, John Castaneda, and it's not just the two losses there, but a little bit of a surprise to end up in the UFC, especially a guy that's 29 years old, and you look at his fifth to last fight, 3 years and 3 months ago. So not the most active fighter. He had a long layoff, you know, between a lot of his fights, but especially the Rojo fight and then the Wood fight. Maybe he's holding out for a UFC contract. He ended up with it, but not the greatest record. Again, if he's active and if he can throw a little bit more volume, I think he could not really overwhelm Wineland, but if he starts mixing in that calf kick, he throws in that, you know, southpaw stance. Really, these guys fight somewhat similar to each other. Again, for Wineland, his hands are down a lot lower than Castaneda's. But for Wineland, he's moving forward with power. For Castaneda, he can move nice laterally side to side. I like the technique over the power in this one. So that's why I'm going with John Castaneda, Matt. We're both going with Minnesota's own, eh? But they're not Canadian. We're going with John Castaneda to get the win. I'm really looking forward to this card, Matt. We have a lot of great prospects. You got Casey O'Neill making her debut. You got a lot of fighters, too, making their second time out. I know another debutante would be Jerry Vandera. So really looking forward to this card. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Really interesting fight at lightweight, and this is one of those ones that gets me up in the morning. We were originally supposed to be having Jakar Close taking on Jai Herbert. Unfortunately, Herbert out of the fight. In steps Luis Pena on 10 days notice. Matt, for Violent Bob Ross, it has been a rocky ride in the UFC, and this is a guy that you talked about the Ultimate Fighter earlier. He came in on top 27. He fought Richie Smullen in the finale, gets a win there, sends Richie over to Bellator. He loses a split decision to Mike Trezano, and that was one of those ones where, would they have fought anyway on the Ultimate Fighter? Well, we'll have them here in an impromptu Ultimate Fighter post-show, maybe? You want to call it that? He loses a split decision. I thought Trezano won that fight, but it is what it is. He would go on to beat Steven Ocho Peterson, Matt Wyman. Ooh, Matt Wyman. Loses a split decision to Matt Frivola, beat Steve Garcia, who came in on short notice to replace Alex Munoz. And then he lost his last time out against Kama Worthy by guillotine. So, Luis Pena, he's been out for about a year and a half, about half a year. And, he gets this fight against Jakar Close, who is kind of good at everything, is he not?
Yeah, Jakar Close, nothing really stands out in his game. And I think because of that, people don't really understand just how good Close is, because you look at some of his past opponents, and yes, he's never been ranked, but he's been in there with a lot of guys who have had numbers next to the names themselves. He's been in there with the Bobby Greens of the world, Lando Venata, someone who, of course, we all know because of his crazy fight with Ferguson. Been in there with the Christos Yagos of the world, the David Tamers, and the Benil Dariush, of course.
And Southern Maine's Devin Powell.
There you go. So he's been in there with some of the best fighters in the world, and the thing for Jakar Close is, even in his losses, he does have these really great moments. And the Tamer fight was weird, because Tamer, who does fight a little bit similar to Luis Pena, there's a bit of a theme with Jakar Close, but he just has a really hard time with opponents who can move a lot or who can out-grapple him. Because for Close, he's a bit of a wrestle boxer, but he's much more striking-oriented than he is wrestling-oriented. And Close, another great comp for him, another guy in the weight division, is Alexander Hernandez. They fight in a somewhat similar manner. I would say Hernandez, he's a little bit more athletic than Close, but just when you look at the overall sort of totality of their games, very similar. But close, he's beaten better guys than Luis Peña. But again, he does struggle with those long, more dynamic strikers who can throw a lot at him. You look at some of his wins. He beat Merch Jacasey, but that was a really weird fight because Jacasey pieces him up and then he kind of breaks his own foot and they just have this weird last two rounds. But anyways, Dracarcos beats him. Fights a little bit similar to Peña. He fights Tamer, who's similar to Peña. He fights Yagos, similar to Peña. There's just been a lot of guys who he's fought who do throw a lot of, you know, weird spinning techniques or very explosive strikers. And he has beaten some of them, but he's lost to some of them as well. So for me, I think Jacare Clos is a much higher ceiling than Luis Peña. I think he should beat Luis Peña. But I can tell you that there is something about Luis Peña's style that will give Jacare Clos a few issues in this fight.
And the thing, too, Jacare Clos is great with your average fighter. And, you know, I say that because if you have somebody that throws decent output, has decent power, Jacare Clos can normally go strike for strike. He can usually out-wrestle most of his opponents. His grappling's not too bad. But as soon as you throw in a weird wrinkle, he usually struggles. I mean, you look at the Christos Yagos fight. What's Christos Yagos' biggest problem that almost got him in trouble against Carlton Minus? His cardio's not the best, and so Jacare Clos does have pretty good cardio. He wins out there. He fights Benil Dariush, and they go strike for strike. Well, Benil Dariush has beaten CDF twice now. Benil Dariush, very good fighter. Jacare Clos got put on a poster. So we haven't seen Jacare Clos in almost a year. Again, he was supposed to take on Jai Herbert that kind of fights like Luis Peña. He's a long guy who can submit you. And again, if you look at Luis Peña and his overall totality of work, he had a very extensive amateur career. He went 8-2 as an amateur. But as a pro, with all of his wins, 4 by submission, 2 by knockout. For Jacare Clos, if you look at the line his way, he's got 11 total wins, 4 by knockout, 7 by decision. So you would think if Jacare Clos is going to go into this fight with Luis Peña, he just has to avoid some of those unorthodox strikes from Luis Peña. He's got to avoid some of those weird grappling exchanges with Luis Peña. Because if Luis Peña gets one of your arms, he could get it all wrinkled up in a strange position. It's like a weird string in a sweater. It's like that weird lace in your shoe that as soon as you cut it at frays, Luis Peña is going to grab that. He's going to take a match and then put it through that hole. What do you think about that?
That was a lot. I'm not going to lie, Craig. Okay. Jacare Clos, I gotta be surprised, and we talk about this in the opposite way, but Jacare Clos should be a much bigger favorite than he is already in this fight, and we normally say it the opposite, oh wow, the odds should be a lot closer. Luis Peña, although I'm a big fan of him, I like the nickname, I like his whole shtick and everything, and I gotta be honest, I sort of undervalued the career of Jacare Clos. I think Clos is a much better fighter than Luis Peña. He's a much more experienced fighter. He's a much more well-rounded fighter. And other than some of the unorthodox techniques of Luis Peña, I don't really know what he does that's going to give Clos problems. He does have unorthodox striking, but Peña needs range to get all those attacks off. And Jacare Clos is a very suffocating fighter who he won't wrestle constantly, but he is always in a range where he can either wrestle you or box you. And he's not going to allow you that space to get off your, you know, lunging punches, any of your long-range kicks and whatnot. So for Clos, I just think if you fight the classic Jacare Clos, don't make this fight crazy exciting or anything. Use your wrestling when you need it. Use your boxing when you need it. Hold him up against the cage when you need it. Just don't do anything crazy, and I don't see how Jacare Clos loses this fight, if I'm being completely honest. For Clos, he has the higher ceiling out of these two. I know people talk about Peña like he is this next really propped up prospect, but personally, and I'm a fan, he hasn't showed me anything that tells me, oh, Peña's going to be a top 15 guy one day. Not that Jacare Clos is a top 15 lightweight, but I do see him as one of those classic, like, 25 to 15 guys who, if you do want to get into the top 15, eventually you have to beat Jacare Clos. And I don't know if Peña's at that stage in his career just yet to beat a guy like Clos.
Coming off a loss, and the thing for Luis Peña, he was always skipping around gyms. I mean, he was all over the place. He's AK at one point. He's been at ATT.
He been to Brunswick, Maine?
Well, he's been at ATT for a while now. So we'll see how that's been paying dividends for him. But again, coming off a loss, you look at the win before that, Steve Garcia, who came in on short notice and really just got out-wrestled by Luis Peña, and Peña had his back for most of the fight. And then he lost a split decision to Matt Frivola, who's a good wrestler in his own right. So for me, you look at the Tapology votes, 664 of them. Again, this fight came in on short notice, 78% close, 83% by decision. If you look at the odds, Clos opened to minus 135. He's now minus 207 on best fight odds. Peña opened to plus 115 or 135, rather. He is now at plus 170. So yeah, plus 115 to plus 170. So Clos is the favorite. The fans are going with Clos. And again, I think if he can make this fight short, if he can get in Clos, sorry, but it's true. If he can get in Clos, push the pace, and especially in a smaller cage, getting ready for a full fight camp against Jai Herbert, who's somewhat of a similar opponent to Luis Peña, I think that definitely helps him out in this one. But hey, maybe Luis Peña No pressure, nothing to lose, like that old Billy Talent song. He goes in there and mops the floor with Jakar Close, and then we're talking about Luis Peña again. But I'm going with Close. You're going with Close. I'm looking forward to this fight, though. It should be a good one. We got a great card coming up. I mean, Nassourdin Imavov's fighting Phil Hawes finally. There's all sorts of great things to look forward to. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Really looking forward to our next fight at featherweight. We have Flash Gordon, Jared Gordon, taking on the Colombian warrior Danny Chavez, and a guy that was counted out by a lot of people in his UFC debut, not including Matt Allen. He had a very, very interesting fight against TJ Brown, where Brown came in overweight. Danny Chavez went full Joe Rogan, and all he threw was a calf kick, and just really screwed the game plan of TJ Brown to the fact that he had to switch stances quite often. Danny Chavez, really good boxing, really good kickboxing, and it's not just that low kick that you have to watch out for. He can throw it from all three different places, and really, if you want to break it down, he can throw it to three different places on your leg as well. So count that as five, maybe. But Danny Chavez, very, very adept striker, representing MMA Masters. We were talking about MMA Masters earlier on in the card, but you've got such training partners as Colby Covington and Ricardo Lamas over there. And again, for Chavez, he was one of those guys that was kind of just lost. Like, you look at the fights that he had, you look at the promotions he was with. Before the UFC, he beat Dylan Calla with Global Legion FC 14. He beat Pipe Vargas that, well, actually, you should know from the regional scene, but he knocked him out. And he knocked out Leandro Magalhães with Shogun fights. And that's the other thing. If you look at Danny Chavez's record, 11 wins, 8 decisions, and 3 knockouts. The 3 knockouts were the 3 coming into the UFC. So he really flipped the switch from 2018 to 2020, really put it on a lot of guys. And he was a guy that didn't fight all that often up until about 2018. And then you saw a progression to where, man, this guy looks like something special. But even before that, he was taking on names like Jordan Parsons that unfortunately passed away, but with Bellator, a guy that ended up fighting with Bellator. John DeJesus, that's on a lot of big-time fighters' posters. So good for Danny Chavez. Very good striker. Very, very good calf kicks. And I mean, listen, I know Chris Gutierrez is really the calf kick king, but Danny Chavez, with a few more fights like we've seen, could end up with that moniker. He's taken on Jared Gordon that now trains out of Sanford MMA. We've seen him with Henzo Gracie's. We've seen him with, what, Rufus Sport. We've really seen Jared Gordon all over the place training in the past. But you look at the fights that he's had in the UFC. He was with CFFC, beat Bill Algeo. I actually really like Bill Algeo. He's a good fighter. Picks up a decision win there with CFFC. He's their featherweight champ. He beats Michelle Quinones in his UFC debut. He beats Takran Diaz. Loses to Carlos Diego Fajeya, Joaquim Silva, beats Dan Moret, loses to Charles Oliveira, beats Chris Fishgold.
So Brazilians are his kryptonite.
Safe to say that the wins and the losses are worlds apart for Jared Gordon. It's weird.
Without a doubt. But here's the weird thing for Jared Gordon. The wins are over fighters who, let's be honest, he probably should have beat them. Even the Takran Diaz fight, when I think we can both agree that's probably his best win when you do look at his whole career. Takran Diaz is on his way out of the UFC. He himself was on quite the lengthy losing streak heading into that fight. So for Gordon, I look at the Fishgold win as probably being his best. And for Gordon, he is a classic wrestle boxer. He did train at Rufus Sport, and I
just want to say, I mean, you look at that Chris Fishgold fight, you got to just break it down really quickly. He had over 10 minutes of control time in that fight, 10 minutes, 22 seconds. And the thing with Chris Fishgold, I know the UFC career wasn't all that good. He's a Liverpudlian that trains with Paddy Pimblett. Chris Fishgold, very, very adept grappler. And for Jared Gordon to have all that control time, to work as many takedowns as he did, he got 3 of 6 in that fight. Total strikes, 241 for Gordon to 27 for Fishgold. That was probably Jared Gordon's best performance.
Yeah, and as I was going to say, and that was the first fight that we did see a very wrestling-heavy style from Gordon. We always knew that he had the wrestling in his back pocket, but he would just go out there and kind of wildly brawl with his opponents. And until the Fishgold fight, we actually saw him going for a lot more takedown attempts. And you do look at some of the numbers on that fight. A lot of it was just ground control time and ground control strikes. He's not a guy who will just posture up and throw bombs from top position. He will focus a little bit more on position over just the domination and overall damage of his opponent. And this is a weird thing for Gordon, because I've seen he himself get dominated on the ground. But you have to remember who that was against. Carlos Diego Fajeya took Jared Gordon down and made his life absolutely hell. Like, that fight wasn't even close at all once it hit the mat. But he fought Carlos Diego Fajeya, one of the absolute best grapplers in really all of MMA, not just the UFC, and not even just the lightweight division. Like, that's how good Diego Fajeya is. So I don't think we can take that much away from Jared Gordon's grappling in that fight. But I do think the Fishgold fight, it is more in line with his opponent of Chavez. Because Chavez, we talk about his striking, we talk about some of his wrestling. His grappling is more similar to a not Carlos Diego Fajeda. It's a lot more similar to a Fishgold. For Gordon, his cardio is wonky because it is good. He can outlast some of his opponents, but I'll compare it a little bit to the cardio of an Ian Heinisch, where they stay at like a 7 throughout the whole entire fight. They never get this great big burst of energy like a Max Holloway in the 4th round, let's say, where they're like, okay, I'm going to really put it on you. He just kind of stays at this similar pace. So if you're a guy who you have phenomenal cardio, you can kind of outlast Jared Gordon. But if you are someone who struggles with the cardio themselves, you will find yourself, that 3rd round is going to be hell against Gordon.
And if you saw the fight that Danny Chavez had against TJ Brown, again, I was pretty complimentary for Chavez. 36 of his total strikes were to the legs. You like that. But for Danny Chavez, in terms of his numbers of strikes, 17 in the first round, 23 in the second round, 12 in the third. And you might say, well, Craig, he got 4 takedowns in the third. He was getting tired in that 3rd round, and the control time reflects it with 1:02 of control time. For TJ Brown, he had 51 seconds of his own. And again, he had TJ Brown's leg totally compromised and wasn't really able to do a ton with it, to the fact where he won that fight 29-28 all the way through. For Jared Gordon, that last time out against Chris Fishgold, 30-26 is all the way across. So for Gordon, it was like, wow, this is a guy that's coming into his own at a later stage in his career. For Chavez, it was like, okay, he's 33, he's almost 34 years old now, but he's 33. This is the guy that we saw on the regional scene doing the things he did on the regional scene. So what are we going to see out of him from now on? Because for TJ Brown, if you know anything about him, he's a main training partner of one man from Arkansas. Matt, you going to help me?
I completely went blank. Man from Arkansas?
Yeah. Bryce Mitchell. Come on! So TJ Brown, he's a main training partner of Bryce Mitchell and really good and adept on the ground. Danny Chavez wasn't really able to let TJ Brown set things up, though he tried. So for Chavez, better striker. For Gordon, really the cardio is usually there. And again, his wrestling is quite good. So, you know, you look at the odds on this one, and Danny Chavez, the biggest mover this week, he opened a plus 155. He's now a minus 136 favorite. And if you look at Gordon, he opened a minus 180. He's now at a plus 111. If you look at Tapology, 30% of 776 total voters have Chavez, and 70% have Gordon, 86% by decision. What do you make of that?
So I do agree with the split. I think if Chavez is going to win, it's definitely going to be by TKO. We've seen Jared Gordon stunned in the past. We've seen him hurt in the past. His striking defense does leave a lot to be desired. Although he was always built out of Rufus Sport, you always hear, oh, him and Bilal Muhammad, him and Paul Felder are so close, and they train really well together, but he does not have the greatest striking defense. And you do see Jared Gordon as one of the more hittable guys in the division. I like his wrestling in this fight, but again, I do think the calf kicks are going to take a lot away from his wrestling and from his own power and really his own striking, because if you do have a Jared Gordon without one of his two legs behind him, he's not going to be able to push off to get his own takedowns offensively, and really just his overall movement will be there to get out of range of the rest of the kicks of Chavez. So in boxing range, I like Gordon. In some of the wrestling exchanges, I like Gordon, especially early on, but I do think Danny Chavez is going to win this fight.
Yeah, I like Chavez as well. Again, maybe you're watching this one first round, second round, third round to see how it goes if it makes it that far, and maybe you like Gordon out of that, especially as now an underdog. But yeah, I like Danny Chavez as far as those striking exchanges are concerned. He's on a tidy little streak, but for Jared Gordon, again, big win his last time out, and if you look at those losses, Oliveira, Joaquim Silva, Diego Fajeda, and I mean, even in the fight that he had against Dan Moret, say what you will about poor old Dan Moret, but it was a closer fight. I know 230-27s and a 29-28 for Jared Gordon, but he is a tricky fighter to try and beat. I think Danny Chavez has the tools in this one. So we're both going with Columbia Warrior, Danny Chavez, to get the win. It should be a good fight. And as far as seeding in this division, it definitely means a lot. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks throughout the week, Matt. We have a great main event between Curtis Razor Blades and the man himself, Derek Lewis, a former title challenger, Derek Lewis. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time featured prelim coming our way. We have the Pitbull, the former UFC heavyweight champ, former affliction fighter, Andre Arlovsky, taking on Team Cowbond's Tom Aspinall. Matt, we've been ranting and raving about Tom Aspinall since before he made his UFC debut. And again, with Team Cowbond, you have Darren Till, you have Mike Grundy, you have the Tom Aspinall. And Tom Aspinall is a guy with a Brazilian jiu-jitsu background. He's been a teacher for a very long time, or an instructor of jiu-jitsu. And it's like he has that in his back pocket and doesn't even touch it, because he took time off from his busy MMA and jiu-jitsu career to become a boxer. And who does he train with? Well, it's not like Joe from down the road or your local celebrity. It's Tyson friggin' Fury. Like, how insane is that? It's Tyson friggin' Fury. And if you watch Tom Aspinall fight, You don't see a lot of heavyweights with A, the confidence, or B, the swagger that this guy has in striking. Very, very high guard. Now, it's not like a tie stance because he keeps both of his feet nice and low, but he's very nimble. Like, he walks in a different manner than most heavyweights do. Again, you see Andrei Arlovsky, he moves around.
Would you say he moves in mysterious ways?
He moves in mysterious ways, but he's fairly not flat-footed, but flat-footed. You watch his fight with Tanner Boser. Boser's in and out, Boser's in and out. And Arlovsky won that fight because of a couple of harder shots than the ones that Tanner Boser threw. And I'll take it to my grave that I scored that fight for Tanner Boser. But the fact of the matter is, Aspinall has some footwork and striking that we just don't normally see out of most heavyweights. And again, we talk at length about the fights that he had before he came into the UFC. The loss to Lukács Porobiec where he had an illegal 12-6 elbow. He's like Jon Jones. The wins that he had, maybe they weren't the best or the greatest
wins. Alain Badeau was a monster, Craig.
Alain Badeau, great fighter. But you look at Tom Aspinall's win. Jake Collier, first-round knockout. Alain Badeau, first-round knockout. And again, just like we said with Chandler when he went to fight Dan Hooker, he's winning the fights against guys you would hope he would beat in ways that you would hope he would. He was supposed to be taking on Sergey Spivak back in October. Spivak fell out, so he got Alain Badeau. And Matt, we tossed a lot of shade Alain Badeau's way because he had a salty salt record, but he was an MMA Factory guy, so you knew there was a connection with Cyril Gane and Fernand Lopez. So in this one, you have Tom Aspinall, great boxer, taking on a career resurgent great boxer, and Andrei Arlovsky, a guy who's gotten more technical with age, we've seen, a guy representing American Top Team, and that's going to be a story. From here on out, it's like almost an American Top Team fighter in every single fight. So for Arlovsky, his last two wins, his 2020 was great. He beat Felipe Lins, the former PFL millionaire, and then he beat Tanner Boser. So you look at that fight, Arlovsky was a pretty big underdog at about a plus 305. Again, I know I took Boser. I still think won the fight.
That fight was terrible and nothing happened. No one deserved to win.
But in this fight, it should be a very interesting one because I don't expect Tom Aspinall to be hesitant whatsoever. Unless Andrei Arlovsky, like, there was a poster of Arlovsky on Aspinall's wall growing up, and, like, he completely idolized Andrei Arlovsky and wanted to be a fighter because of Andrei Arlovsky, then maybe Tom Aspinall's not the greatest guy to pick. But, man, I like Tom Aspinall.
Yeah, I'm not going to use an L word that I've used in the past, but I really like Tom Aspinall in this fight. And here's the thing for Andrei Arlovsky. He's had 75 different stages of his career, but I always remember that losing streak that he had that started with Stipe and kind of ended with Francis Ngannou. And then he sort of had his first career resurgence where, oh, he's not really sitting down on his shots. He's more of a volume striker. And then we have seen him lose a few fights since then. Of course, the Jairzinho Rosen strike where he just got absolutely torched with one punch. But the last two wins have been nice and really, we can open it up, even go back as far to the Junior Albini fight and the Stefan Struve fight. I look at that Stefan Struve fight, and it's an interesting fight because, no, Stefan Struve's not a top UFC heavyweight. I don't really think he ever was, although he retired today, so I should probably say something nice about him. Good dog, Stefan. Andrei Arlovsky wrestled Struve a lot in that fight, and we'd never really seen Andrei Arlovsky wrestle at all up until that point in his career, and he took Struve down three, it might have even been four times in that fight, and just, it's interesting when you see a fighter show a wrinkle that they've never really showed up until that point in their career. And for Arlovsky, listen, no one even thinks about wrestling when they bring up Andrei Arlovsky, but it is some, it's a skill that he has, he just doesn't always show it. Kind of like Aspinall we mentioned with his jiu-jitsu. Now, Aspinall has that black belt jiu-jitsu. He is phenomenal on the ground. We don't see any of it. Arlovsky will threaten a little bit with the wrestling, especially as he's gotten older, because you had mentioned his striking's gotten more technical, but I would say his fight IQ has gotten better as he has aged. And for Arlovsky at this point in his career, it's really easy. Do you have enough power to knock him out, or is he going to beat you by unanimous decision? It's as easy as that. He does have great volume at this point in his career. He doesn't put a lot behind his shots because I think Arlovsky realizes he's a little bit older. He's not getting as many knockouts. He's not even really stunning guys anymore. I can just win via volume and via experience more than anything. Aspinall's different, though, because I don't see Tom Aspinall as being one of those guys who's going to go in there and try to get Arlovsky out in that first minute and, oh, if I don't do that, then I'm just going to kind of be on an island and he's going to be able to out-volume me. For Aspinall, you do have that one-punch knockout power, but you can set up your big shots with your combinations. You don't have to go out there just hoping to land a big right hand or a big overhand shot. You can work behind your jab. You can stay technical throughout the fight. And honestly, if I'm Aspinall, I would do the reverse to Arlovsky is what he's been doing to his opponents lately. I'd wait. I'd be as patient as possible. You don't have to worry about the power coming back your way. So you can stand on the outside a little bit with Arlovsky and download his game plan. Because with a guy like Aspinall, if you are training with the Tyson Furies of the world, with high-level boxers, you're going to be able to sort of download and at least learn the game plan of Arlovski a little bit throughout that first round. And if Aspinall does just play this fight smart, wait on the outside a little bit, wait for the openings that Arlovski will give you, I see this being another first round knockout for old Tom Aspinall.
And again, for Tom Aspinall, the Badeau fight, first round finish. Jake Collier, first round finish. Mikel Ben Hamoda, first round. Sofiane Boukichou, first round finish. Kamel Baziak, first round finish. Like, all of his wins, first round, they're all first round finishes. So you can go all the way through it. His losses, I mean, again, Lukasz Porobiec, 12-6 elbow, and he got caught in a heel hook by Stuart Austin. And Stuart Austin, back at Bama in 2015, who ended with a 15-6 total record. He's only 32 years old. He just beat Satoshi Ishii. So maybe Stuart Austin is a guy that we need to watch. Maybe I'm going to go watch some Stuart Austin tape after this. But for Tom Aspinall, again, jiu-jitsu in his back pocket, incredibly cerebral boxer. We've seen that. Again, I mentioned the footwork, but his combinations are very, very high level. And this is a guy that a lot of people are putting in the same respect as the Ciryl Gane. I know Bozer, before the Arlovski fight, was kind of up there as well, even though he just lost the decision to Gane. But there's a lot of young up-and-comers at heavyweight. Tom Aspinall's in that same breath, only 27 years old. So if you look at the Tapology votes, again, fairly one-sided here. 859 total votes, 73% Aspinall, 83% by knockout. If you look at the odds, Tom Aspinall opened a -275 favorite, now at a -254. And for Arlovski, open a +235, now to +202. So the money's coming in on Arlovski ever so slightly. The fans are going with Tom Aspinall. Matt, who are you going with here?
I like Aspinall in this one. I like him a lot, too. For Arlovski, this is one of those classic fights where it seems like Arlovski could pull off a big upset and win fight by decision. I just think the power and the hand speed of Aspinall will eventually crack the chin of Arlovski. And for Arlovski, we've been talking about this for a while. He is an old heavyweight, but he's been an old heavyweight for the last 10 years. He knows how to win fights, but I just think Aspinall is that next step in the heavyweight division. I think he's too tactical. I think he's too fast. And I think Aspinall's the next big thing.
If you look at Andre Arlovski, too, the fight against Felipe Lins, that was at a fight night back in May, which was held in Jacksonville. They used a full-size cage in that one. The fight against Tanner Boser was in Vegas. That one's a smaller cage. You have a smaller cage in this one, so you know, he's been able to get it done either way. And in the fight against Bozer, too, what was the common theme in that one? Well, Bozer just threw leg kicks, and that was pretty much it. And Arlovski was able to crack him with the hands to the point where it happened late in the rounds. And you can sway the opinion, too, with that.
That's so, not what happened in that fight, Craig.
Yes, it was. So if you go and you want to make a pick on this one, I'm going with Tom Aspinall as well. Again, I like the combinations. I like the power. I would be interested to see, most interested, if this fight goes into the second round and this fight goes into the third round, how it's going. Because for Tom Aspinall, the story's been first round finish. Every win a first round finish. So we'll have to see what happens. But we're both going with England's Tom Aspinall to bring the win back to the boys at Team Cowbond with Mike Grundy and Darren Till. I'm looking forward to this fight. We've got a big heavyweight fight on the main card. You've got Andre Arlovski taking on Tom Aspinall here, but then after that, you have Alexei Olenek taking on a really tough out in Chris Daukaus. So some interesting movers and shakers, maybe trying to take out the old guard of the division, and a great card with Lewis and Blades in the main events. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Fight that was originally supposed to happen back at UFC Fight Night Holloway Cater back in January that was moved because Phil Haas had some sort of weird injury that was never totally disclosed. If you know what it was, let everybody know down below in the comments, but we had a hard time trying to figure out what it was. But all that to say, we've talked about this fight in great detail. You have the 32-year-old Phil Haas, a guy that's been on Contender Series. He's been all over the map, World Series, taking on Nassourdine Imavov from MMA Factory, Ferdinand Lopez, Ciryl Gane, Alain Badeau, all the guys that you know and love. So we're going to go back into that original prediction, and then at the end, we're going to update the odds, and we're going to give our final picks here. Somebody's win streak has to end at middleweight. We have France's Nassourdine Imavov taking on Megatron Phil Haas. And Matt, Calvin Johnson's up for the NFL's Hall of Fame really soon, and we have another Megatron coming in here in Abu Dhabi. And listen, Phil Haas is a guy that I've heard Rashad Evans talk about for the longest time, and I'd say the comparisons have to be, well, at one point they both trained at Jackson Wink and then they moved to Florida, and for Phil Haas representing Sanford MMA, training with some of the best in the world, and this was a guy that when he came into the Ultimate Fighter, when he ended up on Contender Series, there's always been big things expected of him. And I think for Phil Haas, the questions started to come in when he was fighting with World Series. Didn't really go his way, but he really has looked good of late. You focus on his last five huge wins. You look at the win over Kachimurov Bestayev over on Contender Series, the win over Jacob Malkoon. I will never get over because you shouldn't have had to pay for that one on a pay-per-view, but it happened, and he looked amazing in that fight. And for MMA Factory's Nassourdin Imavov, we were so high on this guy coming into his MMA debut against Jordan Williams, and didn't he deliver? And I know he might not have won every round on the judges' scorecards, but by the end of it, you could just look at both guys' faces and tell who won that fight. Nassourdin Imavov put on a great performance. There's a lot of comparisons, and even mid-fight, I believe it was Dan Hardy made the comparison between Nassourdin Imavov and his teammate Ciryl Gane, and not just the fact that they wear the same shorts, although one of them probably a lot slimmer waist size-wise, but they fight very similar. If you want to have another crack at a guy that fights somewhat similar to Nassourdin Imavov or looks like him in the stand-up, it's probably Thiago Santos and the fact that they keep their legs quite spread apart. They're very light on their feet. They keep their hands a little low. But Nassourdin Imavov, a very good striker. If you want to see a good example of just how good his striking can be, not just that Williams fight, but the fight that he had against UFC vet Jonathan Mounier, the Canadian, over with Arias at Arias 1, it's a good example of just exactly what Nassourdin Imavov can do. And maybe he doesn't have the best power, but his volume's there. His grappling's there. He's very good in the clinch. And when he's on the ground, he's not just a fish out of water.
No, and I do think that's an important point to bring up. Because for Phil Haas, he can go out there and knock out pretty much anyone in any weight class at any point. Not to say he'd beat Francis Ngannou, but I think he'd have a chance just because he does hit so hard, and especially for this weight class. But Imavov does have the ability to switch it up. If the striking is going poorly for him, I like his wrestling and his overall game a little bit more than I do like Phil Haas. Now, yes, Imavov is not going to go out there and just start shooting double-A takedowns like he's Gregor Gillespie. He will play the striking game, and that could get him caught early on in the fight. But just as an overall skill set, Imavov does have a little bit more complete game. And for Phil Haas, listen, Phil Haas is one of the oldest prospects you're ever going to see. And he's not in the Eric Silva category where you can lose seven fights in a row and still be considered a prospect and be put in every UFC game. But he is at an advanced age. And he's in that Hany Barcelos category, if you will, where I really like a lot of what they do. I just wish they were about 6 years younger so they could go on the run a little bit earlier. Because for Phil Haas, at 185, it is a competitive weight class, to say the least. And for you to be 9-2... at 32, you've really got to start picking up big wins quick. And a win over Imavov, yes, that might set you up for a, let's say, a Brad Tavares, if you will, one of those kind of maybe bubble top 15 guys. But Phil Haas needs to get to work fast if he wants to make something big happen. And the fight against Imavov, I think, is a risky fight to take, because for Haas, I always assumed that the UFC would match him up in a lot of those, oh, we're going to make Phil Haas fight, not Luke Rockhold, but you get the idea, just sort of a more established name at the end of their career, so he can get a more notoriety fairly quick. And for the UFC to be putting him in there against a guy like Nassourdin Imavov, who, A, is very elusive, so he's not going to be there for the big power shot constantly, and B, just is kind of a well-rounded guy who does specialize in striking, it's a risky fight for Phil Haas to be taken.
And I mean, Jordan Williams, say what you will about him and how good of a fighter he is, I don't care, he lost to Kazula Vargas on the regional scene, that's kind of a weird loss, he did crack Nassourdin Imavov a couple of times, but Imavov rolled with the punches. He has very good lateral movement. Phil Haas moves great in a straight line. Go watch that fight against Jacob Malkoon. And I remember the narrative going into that one was the fact that Malkoon's a training partner, Robert Whittaker. They fight in the same weight class. And this is a classic line. If you ever want to doubt a fighter, it's, oh, nobody wants to fight him. He's 4-0. Nobody wants to fight him. Well, nobody wanted to fight Jacob Malkoon because A, the Whittaker connection, but B, how good he is in jiu-jitsu. Phil Haas walked in there and under 20 seconds knocked him out with one punch. Yeah, so Malkoon just absolutely melted up against the cage, and that was it. Phil Haas is a decent-sized favorite in this one. He's a minus 162, open to minus 181. So the money's coming in on Imavov, who opened a plus 159. He's a plus 135 over on Best Fight Odds. If you have a look over on Tapology, 854 total votes, 77% Haas, 83% have him to win by knockout. And now I have to dispel one thing that you said, Matt. And I'm not going to harp on it. I'm not going to get upset. I do also believe Nassourdin Imavov has a more complete game in MMA. The one thing is wrestling. Phil Haas, JUCO national champ. If you watch some of his early fights, he definitely can wrestle. And it's one of those things that I think if Phil Haas isn't able to land the power shot early, which is definitely a worry if you're a big Phil Haas fan, then maybe he resorts to the wrestling in the later stages of A, the first round, or the second and third. Nassourdin Imavov, I like as this fight goes on. Again, if he can withstand the early power in the first, maybe you look at him in the second and third.
So where you zigged, I'm going to kind of zag. And the same can sort of be said for Imavov. Does he have good footwork? Yes. He has to get hit before he starts using his footwork, though. And for Imavov, he will get on his bike. He does use that really good lateral movement. But it takes him a few hits to kind of remind himself that, yes, I do have really good footwork. And against a guy like Phil Haas, that's not a risk I'd be willing to take throughout the fight. And yes, Phil Haas is the more credentialed wrestler. But the footwork of Imavov is going to make life hell on Phil Haas if he is going in there looking for a takedown. If he isn't able to land that big bomb and he is starting to get tired himself and he's finding himself chasing after Imavov as the fight progresses, things can go south very fast for Phil Haas. The difference is, I still think Phil Haas is going to catch him with a big shot early on. Imavov, yes, he has the footwork, but it takes him a little while to use it, and I think that's all Phil Haas needs. He just needs that one punch. And we say that for some fighters, and normally that's what I look at, and I'm like, oh, I'd rather not pick the guy who has to rely on that one shot. But for Haas, he has kicks, he has power in both hands, and I do think he'll be able to find the shot at some point throughout the fight.
So you have Sanford MMA's Phil Haas taking on MMA Factory's Nasruddin Imavov. Again, these guys were supposed to fight back in January on Fight Island, and now we get them here. So if we have a look over at the Tapology votes, Matt, we've known about this fight for a bit. 795 total votes, 73% Haas, 82% by knockout. Again, I ragged on and on, but I'm still salty at the fact they made us pay for Phil Haas and Jacob Malkoon. I think it's ridiculous. If we have a look at the odds now, Phil Haas opened a minus 118 favorite, kind of bounced around over the last week or so, going up from ever so slightly minus 122. If you look at Nasruddin Imavov, about a minus 102 average, and it's still there on best fight odds. So you've got Phil Haas that's a favorite here. You've got him as a pretty big, I would almost say massive, favorite with the fans over on Tapology. What are your final feelings about this fight here?
First of all, I'm very surprised. Now, here's the thing. The odds should be close on this fight. This is a phenomenal fight. Not only should the odds be close, their records are actually, they are 100% identical. I'm surprised how many people are siding with Haas to not only win, but win by finish. Like, yes, he is a very good finisher when he has his opponent hurt. He is great at not just going for the finish and getting tired, not getting it, but once he does pursue the finish, he tends to get it. But Imavov, he just can fight at so many different ranges, and that's what makes this fight fun. I'm a little concerned about the injury that Haas is coming off of. Again, don't really know how serious it was. Could have been nothing. Could have stubbed his toe. Could have been super major. But again, it was only about a month and a half ago, so hopefully it wasn't anything too crazy. I'm going to side with Imavov just by the slightest of margins, though.
Matt, I'm going with Nasruddin Imavov. I mean, maybe there was an inkling, again, back in that January card. You had gone with Haas in that one. I went with Imavov. I like Imavov for the fact that he can stick a move. I like the technique over the power. But again, Phil Haas is one of those guys that you've heard about for a really long time because he's fought a high level of competition. He's fought in some big spots. Like, you look at it. He wins on Contender Series. He fought on Contender Series 2017. Got finished by, how did that song go again? Miley Cyrus's Julian Marquez. He has lost to Luis Taylor with World Series, and he was on the Ultimate Fighter Season 23 and lost to Andrew Aldearte Sanchez. So Phil Haas has fought in big spots. Unfortunately, he's lost in some big spots, but the wins have been good, and he won on UFC 254, which is a big pay-per-view opportunity for him. So again, I'm going to take technique over power in this one. I'm going to go Imavov over Haas, but it's a super volatile matchup, and you would not be able to find this one on my personal card. So we're both going with France's Nasruddin Imavov, the Russian sniper, to get the win. Let us know if we're crazy people in the comments section, because I know from originally doing this one that a lot of people were going with Phil Haas. I'm really looking forward to this fight. We have a great card. Olenek Dawkus. You've got Minor Rosa. You've got Vieira taking on Kunitskaya. And you have Blades Lewis on this main card for our fight nights. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts are not always created equal, and we have one man with a decided advantage in the number of fights that he's had, because Alexei Olenek started fighting before Matt was born. He started fighting in 1996. I mean, that's kind of between you and I, really, 94, 98. And he has 61 more pro fights than Chris Dawkus coming into this one. We have, of course, the boa constrictor, Alexei Olenek, taking on Chris Dawkus of No Fix nickname. And this is a guy, Matt, and Chris Dawkus, that we had our bones about him when he came into the UFC. I mean, he was a CFFC guy. We've seen a lot of CFFC guys have a lot of success, and gals. I mean, Caitlin Chukagian, Paul Felder, and the list goes on and on. I mean, you have Pat Sabatini making his debut here this weekend. He was a CFFC champ two times. But for Chris Dawkus, coming in here, he had that loss to Zhu and Yanwu, and I thought, it was a fight that he was winning in certain respects until he lost it. And then he beat Danny Holmes, who was 4-4, and then he fought Parker Porter. And he was supposed to take on Sean Teed twice before that, and that would have been a big rematch. Of course, that was Chris Daukaus's second pro loss, and Sean Teed was making his debut. There's a whole storyline around that. So Chris Daukaus comes into the UFC, and he fights Parker Porter, and he finishes him in the first round. Say what you will about Parker Porter, Chris Daukaus looked really good. And in that fight, Chris Daukaus weighed 241. Then he comes out and fights Rodrigo Nascimento. And I thought, well, for Rodrigo Nascimento, he's great at jiu-jitsu. He trains an American Top Team with some of the best heavyweights in the world. Sagano, that's one of them, among others. Chris Daukaus came in weighing 227 pounds, and it was like, holy smokes. Is this guy going to be like a light heavyweight his next time out? Physically, he looked really good. You can tell he's lost a lot of weight in his life, but physically, he looked really good. And he finishes him in the first round. Chris Daukaus has these wild hooks where there's like pop at the end of a shot and he flicks his wrist and he just, it's amazing to watch this guy walk fighters down. So two huge wins for Chris Daukaus in the UFC. They put him on a main card against a guy that's main evented in his last five fights. He fought Alistair Overeem and lost. He fought Wald Harris and lost. He beat Maurice Greene. He beat Fabrizio Verdum. Weird fight. And then he loses to Derek Lewis. But if anything, Alexei Oleinik is consistent in the fact that he always fights the same.
Oh, 100%. Alexei Oleinik loves to walk forward. And, okay, one of two things is going to happen. He's either going to walk forward and eat punches like there is no tomorrow, or he's going to walk forward, get his hands around you, take you down in the weirdest way possible, and choke you out in a way that you never thought was possible, because that's something Alexei Oleinik is well-versed in doing. Interesting fight, because Oleinik, you do look at some of the losses that he's had, and you know how to beat Alexei Oleinik. If you have knockout power, you can beat Oleinik. The thing is, you have to knock him out before he can get his hands around you, and that is much easier said than done, because even if you do go back and look at the Derek Lewis fight, and I know we're going to talk about that performance a little bit later on, but look back at that fight, Oleinik has good success. He gets Lewis to the ground, he has him in kind of a submission, but just kind of the sheer size of Derek Lewis gets him out of it. But Oleinik, even in his losses, does tend to have pretty good moments in the fights. It'll be interesting for Daukaus, though. We talk about the black belt that he does have in jiu-jitsu. I would argue he is not even close to the level of grappling of a guy like Alexei Oleinik. And I'm going to bring up a fight that might bring up some hard feelings for Craig, but Rodolfo Vieira, we say how he's the black belt hunter, how credentialed he is in jiu-jitsu. He doesn't have the MMA experience to really go along with his jiu-jitsu, whereas Alexei Oleinik, I'm not worried about him getting tired in the first 10 seconds and then getting submitted by Chris Daukaus. Although Daukaus is a very good grappler, we just don't really see that side of him all the time. He's not going to submit Alexei Oleinik at all. It's one of the few guarantees I can have for this fight. I do think Alexei Oleinik's probably going to get cracked early and often, because Oleinik himself isn't the biggest heavyweight in the world, and I do think size at a certain point will give Chris Daukaus issues. It's just, this is the fight that's going to do it. If you do look, Curtis Blaydes, the guy in the main event, he's this massive, physically strong wrestler. Well, against Chris Daukaus, who Blaydes probably outweighs by like 40 pounds, Daukaus is going to have trouble with just that relentless attack of a guy like Blaydes. But against Oleinik, who tends to weigh in that sort of 230 to 245 range himself, he's not really going to be able to physically overpower Chris Daukaus.
And you'll see it up on the graphic. These guys weigh the same in their last fights, 227 for both. And I mean, Alexei Oleinik, not the most physically imposing guy, but it's weird because, again, he had his pro debut in 1996, but he's a lighter heavyweight. And so you look at his body of work, he has a loss on his record to one of the greatest fighters of all time. He's had all the belts, he's had all the money.
Undefeated and undisputed.
He fought Chael Sonnen. How crazy is that? Like, Alexei Oleinik used to fight at
in
middleweight.
In Bulldog Outdoors.
Used to fight at middleweight. He's now a heavyweight and a highly credentialed heavyweight with almost 50 pro submission wins, and that's a crazy thing. And you look at his time in the UFC, it feels like he's been there forever, but he debuted in 2014 off a first-round submission win over Mirko Krokop. He's avenged losses to guys like Jep Munson. He has a win over Tony Lopez. And then again, you look at the fights in the UFC. He beats Freight Train Hamilton. He beats Jared Rosholt. He loses to Daniel Malanchuk. He beats Victor Pesta. He beats Travis Brown. Weird fight because he cracked Travis Brown to get him down. Loses to Razor Blaydes. You know, that was a weird fight,
too. He gets his ear tickled.
He beat Junior Albini, which was, again, the Ezekiel choke. But that's the thing. Alexei Oleinik, you saw it in the fight against Derek Lewis. He goes in for that Ezekiel, like, scarf hold, and then he almost would pull guard with it to really try and cinch on it. Didn't work from there. But he finishes Junior Albini. He finishes Mark Hunt, heavy hitter. Loses to Alistair Overeem in a gross fight. Loses to Wald Harris. Gets finished in the first 12 seconds. Beats Maurice Greene because Maurice Greene is a guy that gets tired and he's long and he's awkward. And then he beats Fabrizio Verdum by split decision in a fight that Verdum was coming off that long time away. Was it a suspension? It was a suspension.
It was a suspension.
We're talking PFL's Verdum. Verdum didn't even look like the same fighter that we knew before. But Alexei Oleinik looked pretty good. I mean, his striking was all right. He was all right in the clinch. You knew the Muay Thai was going to cause him issues with Verdum, but it really didn't. And then he fought Derek Lewis his last time out. And this is the thing. Ranked fighter Overeem, ranked fighter Harris, ranked fighter Lewis. So he fights Lewis, and Lewis, again, main event. He's a fourth-ranked heavyweight right now. Lewis goes ham early. Like, he lands crushing blows. Oleinik kind of, you know, he gets hurt, but he's old and he's a curmudgeon, and it kind of wakes him up. And then he gets Lewis into some big brother moments, and he's grabbing him and pulling him up, and he just gets into such weird, weird things that we never see, let alone in MMA, but you never see it at heavyweight. And then the second round starts, and Lewis just gets on him and gets all over him and really just finishes him as he turtles up. So for Chris Daukaus, we know he has the grappling in his back pocket. We haven't seen it. We know that his striking is there, especially with the hooks. You saw it in the Nascimento fight. You saw it against Parker Porter, too. He's good that when he pushes somebody, he doesn't tend to get cracked. His head's usually back a bit. And, you know, we talk about it all the time. It's Cindy Danwa. Hands are always out there. Chris Daukaus is a way more refined version of that. His hands are out
there. Okay, but here, let's reserve the Cindy Danwa for only bad strikers. Chris Daukaus is a phenomenal boxer.
Really good boxer.
Yeah, and that's the really important thing. I just say, the volume that he throws will just frustrate his opponent to the point where they can't hit him back. The problem for Oleinik, again, he normally, the way he's been able to fight so late in his career is, he is the smaller guy, so even though he is a little bit older, the speed hasn't really left him because of the size disadvantage, if you will. The problem is he won't even have that one advantage in this fight. You're just an older version of Chris Daukaus. You're hittable at this stage in your career. And if Oleinik had better wrestling, it'd be a lot easier to pick him in this fight. But unfortunately, he doesn't have the way to get the fight to the ground. And that's why I'm so confident with Daukaus.
I don't have confidence in Chris Daukaus. I mean, it's more of, I have less confidence in Alexei Oleinik. But again, you look at the level of competition. He finishes Maurice Greene, split decision win over Verdum. And then he loses to Derek Lewis in a fight where he had him in bad spots. But Derek Lewis has weird cardio and weird wrestling, and Lewis is able to get out of some of those spots. I don't know if Chris Daukaus is going to win this fight. Does it have to be by finish?
Yeah, Alexei Oleinik's been it's not that hard. Okay, it's probably really hard to knock out Alexei Oleinik. Don't get me wrong. But for top-tier UFC heavyweights, they've been able to do it. And you say, yes, his losses have been to guys with numbers next to their name. I'm going to be honest. I think Chris Daukaus is just as good as Walt Harris. He just hasn't had as many fights to get himself into the top 15 yet. Like, Chris Daukaus and Walt Harris stylistically are quite similar. It's just Walt Harris is a southpaw and Chris Daukaus is orthodox. But Daukaus can switch stances and has a really good ground game. So I know he isn't there yet, but I do see Chris Daukaus as being one of those guys like a Walt Harris who will be in the top 15 for years to come.
I think Chris Daukaus has a great shot. So, Matt, you've already written this off. We haven't even talked about the odds. So we look at the odds, Matt. Daukaus open a minus 140 favorite. He's now minus 180. If we look at Oleinik, open a plus 120. He's now at a plus 148 or thereabouts on best fight odds. Topology votes, 892 of them, 62% Oleinik. And this is where it gets hairy. 82% of those voters think Olenek's going to win by submission. The 38% of voters that picked Daukaus to win, 87% by knockout. So, by definition, you would think there's going to be a finish in this one. So I'd want to see what the over-under is in this. I wouldn't go with just straight Daukaus or straight Oleinik. I'd want to see the props. And again, normally you get those further on during the week, not just on a Monday. If we have a look here right now, Matt, we do have some. So let's have a look. Fight goes the distance, minus 505 that it doesn't go the distance, plus 335. So again, you know, the sites get it. There's probably going to be a finish in this one. Olenek's taking on that top tier competition. And where it gets weird is, you look at guys that have lost to the top tier and you'd have to say, okay, well, they're still in their physical prime, this and that. This guy started fighting in 96 and he's 43. You've got Chris Daukaus, 31, not as many miles on the tank. He's going to be at a reach disadvantage. He has a slight height advantage. And size-wise, they're going to be about the same. So for me, Olenek's a tough guy to beat. Again, I like Daukaus and the fact that he has really, really credentialed, you know, jiu-jitsu in his back pocket. But his hand speed's great. His boxing's great. Alexei Oleinik's hard to go against, though.
He is, but at this stage of his career, it's really hard to say, okay, Oleinik has fought the upper echelon. The only upper echelon guy he's really ever beat, though, is Mark Hunt. And Mark Hunt, at that stage of his career, he was two fights away. That was the fight before he had that fight with
Willis.
Yeah, Justin Willis, and that was one of the worst fights in UFC history, but it was just kind of Mark Hunt who was done with the company. And I know that's, listen, maybe we're giving Alexei Oleinik too hard of a time, but that's his best win by far. Travis Brown, by the time he had beat him, was kind of washed. And then he's gotten all those opportunities against the upper echelon. I really don't think a win over Fabricio Werdum, over the Werdum, I should say, that we saw in that fight is good enough to beat Chris Daukaus. I think Daukaus is going to win this. He's probably going to win it by stoppage. And I'm just really excited because I think that we are getting two of the top heavyweight prospects on this card. I love the fact that they are fighting not back-to-back. There is that one kind of buffer in between those two with the Phil Haas and Ashton Imovov fight. But I really do think Daukaus and Aspinall are going to be two guys that we're going to see around in the top 15 for a very long time.
I like Daukaus a lot, don't get me wrong. But again, I have a tough time siding with him in this fight. Olenek, you have to think, well, we're 59 wins in. We're almost 50 pro submission wins. You have to think that that's the number that he's looking for in this one, or to continue to get closer to it.
I don't think
it.
That's going
to
make him try harder, though, to win a fight.
No, that's why he's sticking around. So I'm going to go with Alexei Olenek in this one. Again, the guy's tricky, and especially for Chris Daukaus, if he can walk Alexei Olenek down and crack him, we saw Derek Lewis do it, the fourth-ranked UFC heavyweight. I do think Daukaus has an incredible ceiling. Again, we talked about Bozer tonight. We talked about Tom Aspinall. We talked about Ciryl Gane. I think Chris Daukaus is up in there around the movers and shakers and the guys that are going to be around for a really long time. But I slightly edge Alexei Olenek, and we'll see what the week has. We'll see what we're thinking on Saturday with Fight Night Picks question mark kicks, where we offer up our final picks for this card. So don't take everything in stone. We might have a change of heart as the week goes on. But I'm really looking forward to this fight, Matt. We're disagreeing on the pick. I'm going Olenek. You're going with Chris Daukaus. But overall, it should be a great fight. We've got a great fight. Fight card, fired, headlined by Curtis Razor Blades, taking on the man, the myth, the legend, the Black Beast, Derek Lewis. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
We have a couple of grapplers entering this fight at featherweight between Derek Minner and Charles Boston Strong Rosa. And I say grappler, but Charles Rosa's last time out against Kevin Aguilar, that one was at 155 pounds. He was a striker in that fight. And we've seen that out of Charles Rosa in his career. You know, he came in with this base or that base. But really, when it boils down to it, he has a weird karate stance. He has decent boxing in that karate stance. He's a little heavy on his lead leg. And as always, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt in his back pocket. And he's grappled with some of the best. And you look at some of the wins that he has throughout his career. To me, the last one over Aguilar, you know, it's a good name, but the winner that he had over Manny Bermudez, pulled guard, thought he was going to be able to get a submission, and out of it, Charles Rosa ended up with an armbar. And I know that sounds weird, but go back and watch that fight. It was an odd one, and an odd one too, because Bermudez, he missed weight in that one. He didn't look all that great in that one. Like, it just wasn't a good fight for Manny Bermudez. It was a great one for Charles Rosa, who was coming off of an over two-year layoff since he had fought Shane Burgos and lost that one by finish. He's got a win over fellow Bostonian Kyle Bochniak. He's got a loss to Aaron Rodriguez by split decision. He submitted Sean Soriano. We could go down through the list. Has a decision loss to the man, the myth, the legend, Dennis Seaver as well. But for Charles Rosa, an American top team staple, he's been with the UFC for a very long time. He's a good grappler. He's a decent striker. He gets hit. He'll give one to take one. It's pretty much Charles Rosa in a nutshell. For Derek Minner, 30 of his 36 pro fights have had a submission in them. Now, he's been submitted and he's submitted some people. And if you look at his UFC tenure, 1-1, he beat TJ Laramie his last time out, and he was a big underdog in that fight, a plus 255 over on best fight odds. And if you look at the fight before that, he was submitted by Grant Dawson in a fight that Grant Dawson, predictably, well, he didn't weigh in where he should have. So for Derek Minner, submits guys, gets submitted by guys. I mean, I'm looking at the fights that he's lost. He lost to Herbert Burns, Kevin Kroom, Jordan Griffin, Fernando Padilla, Chico Camus, Jesse Arnett, Canadian, by Brabo. And then you look at the wins. But he beat Matt Brown, but not that Matt Brown. He beat who? Will Shutt, Justin Overton, Chuka Willis, Joey Munoz, Clay Collard, the boxer. He submitted him in the first round. Derek Minner has really good setups to his submissions, and he has very good wrestling. And you saw that in the fight against TJ Laramie. I know that was the point that I picked out before that fight, where, again, I'm going to get some wrong, you're going to get some wrong. I had the big underdog in Derek Minner based on the wrestling and the inexperience of TJ Laramie was more the thing in that fight, and it ended in the first round by guillotine. But Derek Minner, really slippery with his grappling. His striking's not the best, and his wrestling defense isn't the best, so we'll see what happens here. It's an interesting pick for a main card fight. I gotta end with that.
It really is. Now, I'm gonna agree with some of the things you said on Derek Minner. By the end, you got a little hot and heavy on how good Derek Minner was. Let's be honest. Minner will get out-wrestled by good wrestlers. Grant Dawson was easily... able to do it. Now, you can bring up the fact that, oh, well, he missed weight. Grant Dawson still absolutely dominated him in that fight. Now, the thing...
Really good prospect.
The thing you have to bring up about that fight, though, is that Charles Rosa, we'll talk about his grappling, how good his jiu-jitsu is. His wrestling is nowhere near the level of Grant Dawson. And for Grant Dawson, it's really his top control and his top pressure is where he gets most of his grappling success from. For Rosa, honestly, it's the opposite. If you go for the takedowns on him, he will find success off of his back, but it is sort of that Luis Smolka deal where Rosa will waste time off of his back sometimes going for submissions, and that was a big problem in the Bryce Mitchell fight, because Bryce Mitchell, yes, he's a phenomenal grappler. We all know how he almost twisted Charles Rosa about 9 times in that fight.
30-25s? Like, what a weird fight.
He just completely dominated him, but again, Charles Rosa, he won't have trouble with the jiu-jitsu guys. He struggles with guys who can out-wrestle him who also have decent jiu-jitsu, because if you have that good top pressure, but also good trickiness with your submissions, like Derek Minner has, you can kind of override the mind of Charles Rosa, because with Charles Rosa, unless he does have you in that set submission, you can out-scramble him to a certain degree. And again, we saw that with Bryce Mitchell. And with Bryce Mitchell, you have to understand, scrambling and Bryce Mitchell are like scrambling and Ray Borg. It is the main point of their game. So, of course, he's going to be really good at it. But Derek Minner can follow a very similar game plan in this fight. And for Rosa, I do think the striking will be his best path to victory. He does have that really nice karate style, and it's weird because he will get chopped up with leg kicks, but they don't seem to bother him. He does have a really good poker face, and the only way I can make it similar is him and Wonder Boy are similar, where guys will target their legs constantly. They know they've got the karate stance. They do target their legs, but neither guy ever seems to be overly affected by it. And I understand that's not the best way to go about fighting. If someone's kicking your leg, please, by all means, check it. But if it doesn't bother you, it doesn't bother you. Just a weird fact. I like Derek Minner in this fight, and I like his pressure a lot for Charles Rosa, because for Rosa, it's odd. I like his boxing, I like his karate style. He doesn't have any great attacks that can really earn the respect of Minner on the feet, because for Rosa, it is more of that I'm going to out-volume you game, and it's less of I'm going to crack you with that one big shot, then I'll go for the takedown, and maybe I'll get a submission that way. So for Rosa, if he is on his bike using his movement well at the start of the fight, he might be able to pull out a decision, because we know how good his cardio is, and he can keep a solid output throughout 3 rounds. But I do think the wrestling of Derek Minner is such an X factor that Charles Rosa is really going to struggle with.
And we've seen Charles Rosa go for takedowns of his own right. I mean, again, you can't really look too much into it for Derek Minner. 3 fights under somewhat of a UFC banner. The one on Contender Series got finished by Herbert Burns. The one in the UFC in his debut, he got finished by Grant Dawson. Again, he looked great against TJ Laramie, but even still, limited sample size in a prospect that didn't have a lot of experience. I know going into that fight, Laramie was 12-3, but if you went back and watched it, he was dominant in certain fights, but it was against the fighters you would want him to beat. So take everything with a grain of salt there. But if you look at Derek Minner, good wrestling, good jiu-jitsu. Usually it ends in a submission. For Charles Rosa, he can submit people in his own right too. And again, we talked about the boxing. Negative strike differential for Charles Rosa in the UFC. Don't necessarily love that. Don't really love the strike defense of 49%. Don't really love the fact that his takedown defense is 49%. His submission average per 15 minutes is 0.9. We have a good sample size on Charles Rosa in the UFC. Now, again, had a long layoff. He's had certain fights that, you know, haven't been like the others. And I would say, you know, a fight against Yair Rodriguez isn't going to be like a fight against Bryce Mitchell. So you got to take the two extremes for what they're worth. For Derek Minner, you talked about it. The good wrestling, the good offensive wrestling. And for Rosa, you look at it too. I mean, he has a fight of the night against Dennis Seaver, a fight of the night against Yair Rodriguez, a fight of the night against Shane Burgos, and a performance of the night for himself against Manny Bermudez. So 4 performance bonuses for him. You gotta love that chunk of change if you're Charles Rosa. He's been down in Florida for a very long time. For Derek Minner, represents a gym that we just hear more and more and more often. He's a Glory Fitness and MMA guy, or MMA and fitness. I get the two mixed up. But he's been there for some time, and you talk about the level of training partner there. We said Zach Cummings, we said James Crose, but we saw somebody last weekend pick up a really big one at that gym in Mr. MC, because he has to shave chest, Julian Marquez. So a big win for him. Derek Minner also representing that gym. So Matt, let's have a look at the odds. You had Charles Rosa open a minus 145 favorite, now minus 189. For Derek Minner, opened a plus 125. He's somewhere around a plus 156. If we look at the Tapology votes, 816 of them, 84% Rosa, 39% by decision, 52% by submission. The small amount, the 16% that picked Derek Minner to win, 48% by submission, 41% by decision. It seems to me like you leaned one way in your analysis, so what are you thinking here?
Listen, I like Minter in this fight. Charles Rosa is going to have opportunities to win this, though, and that's why I'm not putting any money on this. Like, I would steer clear of this fight because Rosa is so good off of his back, and it's not like Minter can't get submitted. The difference is, though, when you look at who has been able to submit Derek Minter, it's Herbert Burns. It is the upper echelon grapplers in this division, so I wouldn't really worry too much about him, especially on top of Rosa. I think the opportunity might be there for Rosa if he is able to grab an arm, if he is able to maybe lock up a triangle. But unless he is able to get, and I'm going to use the term Hail Mary, but unless he is able to get a submission off his back, I just don't see it for Rosa in this one. He could win this if he is able to keep it on the feet. Maybe he can outvolume his way to a decision, but I see it more likely than not just being a Derek Minter going out there out-wrestling Charles Rosa, maybe passing guard here or there, but just fighting sort of a conservative fight on the ground.
The thing that makes it tricky for me, especially if you're focusing on the guy, and I'm hopefully, somebody's going to correct me here, but I'm 95% sure it's Peabody. He's from Peabody, outside of Boston. It's not Peabody. Joe Martinez saying it that way. It's Peabody. You look at the fight that Charles Rosa had with Kevin Aguilar. Very close fight again. Split decision. If you look at the amount of takedowns, Aguilar went 0 of 2. Kevin Aguilar is a good wrestler. Charles Rosa was up a weight class taking on a guy like that. So I like Rosa's striking. I'm all right with the takedown defense. I like that fight against Aguilar, up a weight class. I like him in this fight. Again, I talked about it. Negative strike differential. Maybe I don't love his striking defense, but it's not like Derek Minter is the best boxer that's out there or that this world has seen at featherweight. So I am going to side with Boston Strong in Peabody's own Charles Rosa. Mike Heck's going to have to let us know if we're right there. Friend of the show. So I'm going to go with Rosa. You're going to go with Minter. But overall, a weird fight at featherweight, and it wouldn't make it onto my card whatsoever. No, so I'm really looking forward to this one. We got a great main card, even ahead of this still. Your co-main event, Ketlin Vieira taking on Yana Kunitskaya. And in our main event, Curtis Blaydes taking on Derek Lewis. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, Matt, let's get into it. And support for Fight Night Picks is brought to you by Manscaped. Who's the best in men's below-the-waist grooming? Big news, Manscaped just released their new cologne scent to help you feel good and smell good all over at all times. Who knew smelling this good could feel this good? To Matt, Manscaped, distressed by over 2 million men worldwide. Join the movement for all your below-the-waist grooming needs. Now, Matt, the people at home, on the drive home, wherever you might be, because you might be listening to the podcast version of this, you've heard me talk about Manscaped in the past. Now, I haven't had the chance to talk about Bad BO and their new cologne, so I will. You know, Matt, I love the Lawnmower 3.0. I've told you about shaving in the shower. It's got that nice LED light. They say to use the We Save Your Balls newspaper because you can put it down on the floor and you can wipe your trimmings in it and then throw it out. I think that's a little weird. I like it more as a prop. I haven't done it to this one in particular, Matt.
And that's
would be weird
glad I've held
if you grabbed it. But overall, I have shaved my nuts with this exact razor. Would you like it?
No, I'm good. All right, that's fair. Works great, though.
It does work very well. Now, they've just come out with their new cologne. Everybody knows them for the Perfect Package 3.0 for all those below-the-waist grooming needs. But they didn't stop there. They brought in the Refined Cologne Signature Scent by Manscaped. It's got that same signature scent as the other Manscaped formulas that you're familiar with, the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. I've spritzed this stuff on. I did this morning. It's great stuff. They also have the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's like a salve. You just lather that stuff on there. You're going to have a good day with the Crop Preserver. But they just brought out the cologne. I think mine should show up in the mail this week. I think yours should as well. So we'll let you know how it goes. But it is great stuff. It's got a light, approachable, gentlemanly feel. Think of it as your wingman for the night to keep you fresh and ready for anything. You want to smell good on that Zoom call virtually? You're going to have the confidence with this Manscaped clone. It's calming and inviting. The signature scent introduces a light citrus burst before settling into the anchoring notes of vetiver and the woodsy masculine finish. It's a 50 milliliter spray cologne. It's even hypoallergenic, cruelty-free, dye-free, paraben-free, and 100% vegan. I wouldn't suggest eating it, but it's good to know that it's 100% vegan. There's not, like, some weird bits of something in there. You don't have to worry about that. But you can keep your bits nice and high and tight with the Perfect Package 3.0. It's got the Lawnmower 3.0. You've heard me talk about it. But again, I'm a shower shaver. This is great for it. They also have the Weed Whacker. You've seen me do this in every show, but you can get into that ear hair. You can even get that nice nose hair fixed up. So we're talking ball deodorant toner. You're making your testes your besties. And now you can use the new Manscaped Redefined Cologne to complete your set and smell great at any time, anywhere. It's time to feel sexy. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP at manscaped.com. Your balls and body will thank you again. 20% off and free shipping. It's a promo code FNP at manscaped.com. It's a great deal. They're great products. We wouldn't be behind them if We didn't think so.
Exactly.
And we're going to be bringing you more content provided by Manscaped as the show rolls along the next couple of months. And it's awesome to have the company behind us. And it's awesome that you help support them and support us as well. So, FNP, manscaped.com, 20% off of free shipping. Using that promo code, look good, smell good, feel good with Manscaped. Really interesting fight. We have top 10 ranked women's bantamweights. Ketlin Fenomeno Vieira taking on Yana Kunitskaya. And listen, you know the tape and the story on Yana Kunitskaya. She had an interesting fight in her UFC debut against Chris Cyborg. She lost the fight, but she gave a good account of herself. I mean, she almost got a takedown in that fight.
She got finished in the second minute.
Yeah, she did get finished. But, you know, it was different. And so after that, she had some good fights. She had a couple of good wins. Lena Landsberg, the elbow queen. She beat Marion Renault. Somewhat controversially, her eye was ballooned right up in that one. Loses to Aspen Ladd, gets finished there. And then beats Yulia Stolyarenko in a fight where it was supposed to be Ketlin Vieira. And you ended up with Stolyarenko that a lot of people recognize from The Ultimate Fighter. Ketlin Vieira is one of the strangest cases in MMA because she believes incredibly in her boxing. She has some good power. She trains out of Nova Uniao, so you'd expect it to be there. But really, her bread and butter is her wrestling and her ground game. And for Ketlin Vieira, she was ranked second at one point in the UFC's bantamweight division. She took on Irini Aldana. And if you look at the odds, I'm going to look at them on Tapology. She's a minus 230 favorite, according to them. She got finished in the first round by Irina Aldana's striking. This fight was supposed to happen three different times last year. Once in May, event canceled due to coronavirus. It was supposed to happen at the start of August, and then it was rescheduled, and Vieira withdrew. She eventually would fight Sajara Eubanks. She won, predictably, a decision against Sajara Eubanks. She was supposed to take on Marion Renault in that fight. Renault was hurt. So now we get her fight, finally, with Yana Kunitskaya. Vieira's at 6. Kunitskaya's at 7. Stylistically, clash of styles, I would say. And for Yana Kunitskaya, she's taken on grapplers in the past, and she's lost to some good grapplers. The other thing is, in her last fight, it was against Yulia Stolyarenko, where she just pushed the pace. She got Stolyarenko with her back up against the cage. And if you knew anything about Yulia Stolyarenko, it was that her striking wasn't very good, but her ground game was insane. Like, she could pull off weird submissions off her back. So she tried to pull, like, a guillotine as she climbed up the cage with her back to it. And really wasn't able to do a lot. I know she threatened at one point with an armbar off of the ground in that one, if I'm not mistaken, near the end of one of the rounds. But overwhelmingly, Kunitskaya won that fight. And if you look at this one again, Kunitskaya, better striker. You got the better ground game from Ketlin Vieira, who has 92% takedown defense in the UFC. And if you look at Kunitskaya, 33% takedown defense. We saw it work in the fight against Stolyarenko, who came in on short notice. So overall, clash of styles. Weird co-main event, but I like it.
I have no idea who's going to win this fight, and I've got to say that, right? Just to start this whole thing off, because it is such a clash of styles. Kunitskaya can grapple off her back a little bit, but if you are on the ground with Ketlin Vieira, there's no way you're going to submit her off of your back. She is by far, I say by far, but other than Amanda Nunes, I would say Ketlin Vieira is the best grappler in this division. And even if you just go back to the Sarah McMahon fight, and trust me, no one's more critical of Sarah McMahon than your boy over here, but she was put in some bad positions in that fight, especially on the ground. McMahon herself was able to lock up a submission on Vieira, but Vieira was just able to stay calm, really focus, and then not only flip and get out of the head and arm choke, but put one on Sarah McMahon herself, like, almost right after. And it was really high-level grappling from Vieira, and it shows to me that even on her back, in the worst position possible, Vieira can work her way and build to a great position herself. And for Kunitskaya, she has decent wrestling. A lot of her takedowns do come more from those head and arm throws that we see a lot more in women's MMA than we do in men's. But going for any of those arm throws, and here's the thing too, I don't predict Kunitskaya will go for a single takedown in this fight. It's just, if she does, her takedowns are the worst kind to go for against someone like Vieira, who is so good at taking the back. And if you are going for any of those head and arm throws, you're kind of just giving your opponent the back, especially if they are a very high level black belt like Vieira is. But for me, you look at the Vieira fight, especially against Irina Aldana, and Aldana is like Grasso. I'm not the first person to say that, because everyone mentions those two together. But that fight was a great case of Aldana is a good striker who is just very technical. She doesn't have murderous power by any means. Where then you have Vieira, who has confidence in her boxing, but I wouldn't say she's a great boxer
so
by any means.
So wild.
Exactly. So you have Vieira throwing a wild shot, and Aldana just kind of waiting and catching her with a really nice left hook herself. I don't know. Vera herself is elite, but she's never beaten an elite fighter. And that's what really worries me. And I can really throw both of these fighters into that category. The best win Kunitskaya has is over Marion Renault. And beating Marion Renault is a very hard thing to do, don't get me wrong. But Renault isn't really an elite fighter at this stage in her career. And
telling me a woman that's like 44 years old?
Exactly. Listen, she beat the brakes off both of us in the same day without breaking a sweat. But against Kunitskaya, and really in the UFC against the upper echelon, it's just tough for Mary to know at this stage in her career. So the fact that Kunitskaya's best wins against Renault is a little concerning. But then on the flip side, Kellen Vieira's best win is either, what, Katsingano, which was a weird split decision that Vieira probably won every round in, but still a weird decision fight. And then she has that nice arm triangle win over Sarah McMahon. It's just, you look at the wins of both, and I do think that both are somewhat elite, but neither has that really impressionable win that puts them over the edge and says, like, hey, you deserve a title fight. Because I think Vieira, she's been flirting with that kind of top three of, oh, maybe I should fight Amanda, maybe I need that one more win. If she gets this win just because 135 needs a new title challenger, maybe they will match her up with, like, a Juliana Pena, then you could have the winner of that potentially fight for the title in the future. But it's just such a weird fight between two fighters that I don't have a great read on.
Caitlin Vieira in her last fight against Tajara Eubanks, and I get it, but she threw no leg kicks. How crazy is that? Like, again, Tajara Eubanks is a good wrestler, but Caitlin Vieira is a judo black belt and a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. So maybe you let things fly with your leg kicks and you try to slow down the wrestler, but she didn't. And she picked up a decision win there, 29-28 across the board. She was able to outstrike Eubanks at a lower percentage. She went 2-5 on her takedowns. Eubanks went 0-1. Interesting to me. I mean, Eubanks went for that takedown late in the third. And again, you talked about it, the wins. She beat Katsingano by split decision almost 3 years ago. She beat Sarah McMahon 3.5 years ago. Like, it's kind of crazy to think of that. She had that loss to Irene Aldana back in 2019. Took almost a full year off between that and the fight against Eubanks. And if you look at it for Yana Kunitskaya, you look at the level of competition that she took on over with Invicta and with some of the other organizations she was with. I mean, she beat Cindy Dandois and finished her with M1 Challenge. So we talk about Cindy a lot. That was 11 years ago. Well, 10 years ago.
Cindy Dandois t-shirts.
She beat Wu Yanan. That's a good win. She had that weird fight against Tonya Evinger where you can't stand on somebody's face. And then she lost to Tonya Evinger. She beat Raquel Canuto. And then it was the loss to Chris Cyborg that main evented UFC 222 for the UFC featherweight belt. Kind of crazy. Landsberg win, Renault lose to Aspen Ladd, beats Yulia Stolyarenko. And again, Kunitskaya has pretty good striking. Kunitskaya has pretty good top pressure, too. She can get kind of caught in some submissions. You saw that in the fight against Stolyarenko, but she was able to get out of it and get the win. So for me, it is a difficult fight. I'd leave it off my card. The odds had Caitlin Vieira a minus 275 at open, about a minus 272 right now for Kunitskaya, plus 235 at a plus 217. If we look at the topology votes, Matt, not really all that close. 867 total votes, 86% Vieira, 84% by decision. This is one of those ones that you pick Vieira and then you look like a donkey if she loses, because all the topology voters had her and the odds were overwhelmingly Vieira. I like Vieira in this fight. I don't love how wild of a striker she is, because that's the thing. Wild striker, a lot of power, not a lot of technique. Trains at a Novo União. Those things don't mix, but her ground game's really, really good. And she's a jiu-jitsu black belt and a judo black belt. So if the fight hits the mat, it's overwhelmingly Vieira. But every fight starts on the feet, as they say. And that much is true. And that would, that would obviously lend credence to Kunitskaya. But again, I don't love that when Kunitskaya tries to bring it to the mat, we're talking a lot of head and arm throws that Vieira would specialize in herself. I don't think the clinch positions really favor Kunitskaya. So I like Vieira in this fight, and I'll take her. But again, I don't like the odds. I don't like the topology votes. I wouldn't feel confident in picking this card if I was putting it on a parlay or anything.
I agree. Both fighters have lost to similar fighters that their opponent is. Like, Vieira can fight in a very similar way to an Aspen Ladd, where she does do that kind of wet blanket, I'm going to get on top, ground and pound submission. But then Kunitskaya, again, I don't think her technique is similar to an Aldana, but she can just wait on the outside, sort of pepper you with those long-range attacks. So I agree. I'll pick Caitlin in this fight. Not my most confident pick, especially where the odds are at right now, but I do see her getting this fight to the mat at some point throughout these three rounds and probably dominating from there on.
To the person that comes back on Sunday morning, this is a parlay buster. Oh, so yeah, watch out for it. We're both going with Ketlin Vieta to get the win, but I cannot preface that. Like, there's got to be a warning there for somebody. Overall, really looking forward to this card. We have a great main event coming up between Curtis Razorblades and the Black Beast, Derek Lewis. I love it. That should be an awesome fight. So really looking forward to it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
This is quite literally a main event months in the making. We have Curtis Razorblades taking on the Black Beast, Derek Lewis. And listen, you can find us, as always, at Craig Allen FNP, over on Twitter and Instagram, at Matt Allen FNP there as well. And we have a great card this weekend, but of course headlined by this heavyweight banger that was originally scheduled to take place on the 28th of November. Unfortunately, Curtis Blades out due to a positive COVID test. So they shuffled it around and we get it now. And we have a couple of top five ranked guys here with totally contrasting styles. And you don't normally say that at heavyweight. Normally it's, we're going to swang and bang and somebody's going to get knocked out. And in the case of Derek Lewis, that's what we pretty much always get. And in the case of Curtis Blades, he either beats you or he loses to Francis Ngannou and that's it. So he's lost twice to Francis Ngannou by finish, but every other time out there he won, except for the time that he tested positive for the weed and he couldn't beat that test. But every other test he has. Now for Derek Lewis, 24-7 with 1-0 contest, he's taken on a very high level of competition. And the funny thing is, you look at the common opponents between these guys, they fought six common opponents. Volkov, Dos Santos, Abdurakhimov, Ngannou, Hunt, and Alexei Olenek. And while they might not have won every fight, and Curtis, I'm looking at you, they have had pretty good results against the top guys. Blades ranked second, Lewis ranked fourth. And for Derek Lewis, it's another career resurgence. Like, you thought this guy was done when he got finished by Mark Hunt. And not really. He looked, well, he was hurt against Mark Hunt. He had that weird kick to the stomach against Travis Brown in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. And then after those two fights, he beats Marcin Tybura after getting taken down and dominated for most of the fight. He beats Francis Ngannou in the worst fight you've ever seen. He knocks out Alexander Volkov pretty much the same way he finished Marcin Tybura. Like, he got dominated and then Hail Mary at the end and he finishes Alexander Volkov. Out of that, he gets a title shot and loses predictably to Daniel Cormier. Then he fights Junior Dos Santos and he loses, and that was a weird one.
It was, but again, with Derek Lewis, here's the thing. There's two versions of Derek Lewis. There's Ow My Back Derek Lewis, and then there's, wow, the Black Beast Derek Lewis. And for Derek Lewis, again, the version that we've seen in those losses, you look at the Mark Hunt fight, his back was just giving out on him, and then he ends up losing by TKO. The Daniel Cormier fight, he gets ankle picked, and that fight was just terrible stylistically for poor Derek Lewis. And that was weird because it was on short notice for both guys.
Fans cheered Derek Lewis in that one and booed Daniel Cormier,
which is very odd. And then you look at the Junior Dos Santos fight. Again, he kind of gets hurt midway through, and it's one of those really weird Derek Lewis fights. And we can kind of say that for all of his fights. There's always periods of Derek Lewis's fights where it looks like he's on the brink of defeat just so he can bring it back and win. And the Alexei Olenek fight really was no different. And I look at the Olenek fight, I look at the Tybura fight, and I look at the Shamil Abdurakhimov fights for the opponents of Derek Lewis who most clearly emulate Curtis Blades. And let's be honest, Lewis didn't do well against all three of those guys, even though he beat them all, which is very odd. But he does get taken down multiple times in all of those fights. And for Blades, the Volkov fight's probably the best one to look at if you are trying to bring up someone who fights in a similar way to Lewis a little bit, just because Lewis really is. It's like 10 out of 10 in my stand-up. My grappling is only good enough to get me back up to my feet. And of course, we all know Derek Lewis might be the best person to say, like, jiu-jitsu's not even real. I don't care. I don't need a black belt. I don't need a blue belt. I don't need a white belt. I can just get back up to my feet. The issue is, he's been able to do that against guys like Alexei Olenek, a very small heavyweight. He was able to do it to a Marcin Tybura, who just fatigued later on in the fight. He did it to Shamil Abdurakhimov. Interesting, because that was also a five-round atmosphere, similar to this fight, where Abdurakhimov predictably wrestled Lewis for about 3.5 rounds, and then gets knocked out in the fourth. With Blades in the Volkov fight, he does out-wrestle Volkov consistently throughout that fight, secures, I think, 15 takedowns, which is an absurd amount of takedowns to get in a fight. But you do see, as that fight progresses, that the takedowns don't come as easy in that third round. And in the fourth round, he is just kind of blatantly reaching down for legs at a certain point and leaving his head open to be hit. And that wasn't the same Volkov that we're dealing with nowadays, the 265-pound Alexander Volkov. That was Slenderman Volkov, if you will, the only 200-pound.
Now it's Thick Boy Winner Volkov.
Exactly. And it's really curious to me, I guess, because Thick Boy Volkov might have beat Curtis Blades that night. Maybe he gets taken down 15 times and completely dominated too. But it is really interesting that Blades' cardio, I thought, was once his biggest asset. But the first time I saw him in a really hard 5-round fight where both guys are pushing each other. His gas tank completely failed him.
The weird thing about Derek Lewis, if he doesn't get hurt, a la JDS or the Travis Brown fight was a weird one because, you know, Mario Yamasaki just kind of closed his eyes for a little bit. Or the fight that he had against Merrick Hunt. If you look at the other fights, Marcin Tybura, I'm just going to springboard back up to my feet. The fight against Francis Ngannou, well, it was boring. The Volkov fight, he was always in it, even though he was getting pummeled. The Blagoy Ivanov fight, pretty boring. I mean, both guys, you want to talk similar. Derek Lewis has some more power. Blagoy Ivanov has a little bit more in terms of volume. It's a split decision fight. It is what it is. He beat Alir Latifi. Alir Latifi's not a heavyweight.
No.
Alir Latifi's a small, light heavyweight at that. So Alir at heavyweight, weird stuff. And then the fight against Alexei Olenek. Well, Lewis goes ham early, and then Alexei gets him down. And he gets him into a choke, kind of gets him, pulls him in. But Derek is the biggest guy for this division, and he's not able to do it. Now, it might have looked like we were both going
and
to
kiss.
And
that's why you couldn't get the choke in on me, because I'm so big.
Yeah. Slenderman Matt. Now, but in that fight, he wasn't able to get it. Olenek wasn't. And then the second round starts. Now, Olenek, as far as cardio is concerned, normally pretty, you know, until like the third maybe or late
into the
second.
About the average cardio of a 45-year-old male.
Well, he's only 43.
Oh, my bad.
But he started fighting in 96, 2 years before you were born. But with Alexei Olenek, second round starts, and what does Olenek have to do? He's got to kind of creep in there. And as he creeps in, he gets caught by Derek Lewis. He goes down. Lewis pounds away. Maybe a few extra shots. And then Herb Dean steps in and ends the fight. So Derek Lewis, big win there. Again, this fight was supposed to happen back in November. One of two things is probably going to happen. And I say probably. Curtis Blaydes out-wrestles Derek Lewis. Derek Lewis gets tired, and that's the fight. The trouble for Curtis Blaydes is when he out-wrestles guys, sometimes he has great finishes, like when he fought Alistair Overeem. Sometimes he gets tired, like when he fought Volkov. And again, unless you're Francis Ngannou, well, nobody's beaten Curtis Blaydes except for the drug test against Adam Milstead, where he finished him. But out of the UFC wins, again, you had the first fight against Ngannou when he made his debut. He beat Cody East, Daniel Malanchuk, Alexei Olenek, Mark Hunt, Alistair Overeem, lost to Ngannou, beat Justin Willis, go home, big titty, go home. Beat Shamil Abdurakhimov, bad. And that's the fight where, you know, you want to draw comparisons. Blaydes fought Abdurakhimov, who's a pretty good wrestler, and Blaydes just totally stomped him out at UFC 242. Now, was it the heat? I don't know, but it didn't seem to affect Curtis Blaydes all that much. He beats and finishes JDS, who's been on a finish losing streak, and I'm not talking about the country. And then he fights Volkov and just totally out-wrestles him. Like, he wrestled him like Mrab Dushvili wrestles guys at 135. That's how many takedowns he got. It's insane. So if you want to look at the stats, again, you can't throw too much at them because Derek Lewis is this weird anomaly of a guy that can just springboard back up to his feet, even in the later stages. But the striking numbers favor Blaydes because normally he's on top hammering away.
Exactly.
The grappling number, 6.98 takedowns per 15 minutes, and Blaydes has been in 5-round fights like this one. 33% takedown defense for Blaydes because really if you take him down, not a whole lot's going to happen. 55% accuracy, that's pretty good. For Derek Lewis, 52% takedown defense. Not awful, but not great. Like, you like to see that above 60% and up. He doesn't really go for many takedowns of his own. His striking numbers, fairly flat in terms of landed and absorbed per minute. Like, they're relatively close. And in terms of averages, 44% defense to 50% accuracy. You don't love the defense, but this guy is such an oddball. Like, Derek Lewis, if you put him over in the Bellator heavyweight division, I know he'd have a lot of success, but he's ranked fourth in the UFC's heavyweight division. He's what, 36 years old? He just turned 36, so happy birthday. He had a birthday this month. It's just crazy to think the career this guy's had. Like, I've gone back and done the deep dive and looked at the guys that he's fought, like, way back in the past. Like, Jared Rosholt with Legacy, fought Jack May, who we just saw fight with XMMA. He fought Tony Johnson. He fought Rakeem Cleveland in Cleveland's UFC or MMA debut, who was with the PFL at one point. Like, just such a weird career for Derek Lewis with Bellator and all these other organizations. It's great to see. But again, when it all boils down to it, Derek Lewis is either going to knock out Curtis Blaydes or Blaydes is probably going to just dominate Lewis on the ground.
Yeah, that's really what this fight comes down to. Now, Derek Lewis does throw the techniques that he has to do to counter a wrestler. What do wrestlers get caught with? Flying knees and uppercuts. Those are Derek Lewis's best techniques, and it's weird because Derek Lewis throws a really nice double flying knee from the left side.
And the head kick from Derek Lewis, too.
No, but don't throw head kicks against the wrestler, though. Down. Exactly. Consistently. So don't do that. But the flying knee is a really good technique. The problem for Lewis is he lands on the chest a lot, and if Curtis Blades does duck down into it, yes, it might catch him on the chin, but you might also just be making Curtis Blades' job easier for him. So I'll be interested to see if Derek Lewis focuses more on defending takedowns to fatigue Curtis Blades and then try to knock him out late in the fight, or does he get taken down? Does he just kind of get controlled and fatigued himself? So I'm going to say Curtis Blades. I'll probably say by decision, although we all know what can happen in a Derek Lewis fight.
So we threw this one out there in the YouTube community tab. Big time heavyweight contenders clash in next weekend's main event. Who's going to get the win? 72% of 1,400 total votes went with Curtis Blades. 28% went with Derek Lewis. Again, that's a decent sample size over there. If we have a look at the odds, Matt, Derek Lewis open to -300, Blades open to -300 favorite. He's now -395. If you look at Derek Lewis, open to +250. That line shifted a lot in the last couple days. He's now a +299 underdog. So again, the fans, the gamblers, everybody's pretty well going with Curtis Blades. But the X factor is Derek Lewis can put anybody's lights out. And also, he has that kryptonite. He beat Francis Ngannou. Curtis Blades couldn't do it in the two times.
If MMA math was a thing you could get a PhD in, then maybe Derek Lewis could win this fight. But unfortunately, again, when you have a guy whose best path to victory is maybe he can land a big shot, it is really hard to pick them. And Derek Lewis is that fighter who, listen, if anyone can land a big shot, it is Derek Lewis. And he makes less sense than any other MMA fighter probably on the UFC's roster. But again, the confident pick and the safe pick is Curtis Blades. He has the wrestling advantage. He probably does have the cardio advantage, even though we say all the jokes about the Volkov. He went for 25 takedown attempts. And Volkov, yes, he got taken down, but those aren't easy takedown attempts. You do have to work for all 25 of those. So I'm going to pick Blades. Lewis has that knockout X factor, but again, Blades by decision is a pretty easy pick.
I'm going to go with Blades as well in this fight. But again, Derek Lewis, he's got that stopping power. He's really kind of come out on top as an underdog in the past, too. So, you know, if you woke up the next morning and Derek Lewis won, it wouldn't be the biggest surprise. But yeah, we're both going to go with Curtis Blades in this one, Matt. Overall, what a great card. I mean, we talked about a lot of great fights. Your co-main event, Vieira taking on Kunitskaya, top right bantamweights. But you got some great ones throughout. Some other aging heavyweights, Alexei Olenek and Arlovski taking on Dacus and Aspinall, respectively. The fights that we're looking forward to most. I mean, Dracar Close, Luis Pena, Eddie Wineland, John Castaneda. You got Julian Arosa, Nate Landwehr. And I mean, another possible fight of the night, Zahabi Rodriguez. Kicking off the card, Rafael Alves taking on Pat Sabatini. It's a great card.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't miss Fight Night Picks Kicks that one on Saturday, 2 hours before the prelim start. Maybe we have a change of heart in some of our picks. Those are the ones that we lock in and go with at the end of the week. So hopefully you can join us there. Fight Night Picks Kicks. It's a lot of fun. Overall, really looking forward to this card, Matt. And as we always say, with Fight Night Picks,
let's get into it.